world of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. It's the David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Wednesday, the 8th of April, year of our Lord, 2026. Well, today we have a couple of interviews. As I mentioned yesterday at the close of the show, I'm taking the day off for our anniversary. We weren't able to go out on our actual anniversary because we were snowed in. And so I'm not here, but we recorded a couple of very interesting interviews. One of my favorite recurring guests is Eric Peters, and he's going to be coming on first. But stay tuned, because we also have a new guest that we've never talked to before, John Ferguson. And he is the CEO of a company that manufactures drones. He's had a lot of military experience. And of course, drones have become front and center in this war with Iran. And it's also going to be front and center in terms of domestic threats that are upcoming. So we're going to talk about that, and about the recent overflying of the military bases, where we've got a couple of high-ranking officials there, and what happened with the great mystery of the drones on the East Coast about a year and a half ago. Well, it appears that the central part of that is something that he's still very concerned about, and we may be seeing something about that in the future. Hopefully not, but joining us first will be Eric Peters. Right, joining us now is Eric Peters, and he's no stranger to this program. We always love talking to Eric because he focuses on things dear to my heart, and I think yours as well, liberty and mobility. And you can find Eric at ericpetersautos.com. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dave, and thank you for the wonderful introduction. I would only add sanity to your profile.
Well, you do add sanity to our program, so it's always great to have you on. Especially, I like the fact that you've had since all this insanity began under Trump back in 2020, you started putting out the diaper report, and now you've got a new one, which is the war tax report. And I think the titles that you chose with both of those say it all. Really, it is the diaper report, and you've got a picture on your website of I think it's Japanese women or something who are modeling their underwear on the outside. And you always referred to it accurately as the face mask being the face diapers. And so that is still going on. That insanity. Here we are 6 years later. That's still going on.
It is, because it's not been cured. Yeah. The article that I posted about this the other day was inspired by something that I saw at my bank. I was sitting in my car and another car pulled up next to me. And in it was a woman by herself wearing her mask. And, you know,
with the windows rolled up, right? She's not in a convertible, right?
My attitude is shifting a little bit. You know, initially I used to feel irritated about these people. You know, why don't you take the thing off? You don't have to wear it anymore. But I've come to realize that they have been so hystericized, so PTSD by the nonstop barrage of propaganda, which they're continuing to receive probably from their doctors of all people.
Oh yeah.
You know, they go into the doctor's office and the doctor's probably wearing one of the things, so, you know, or the nurses, mm-hmm. you know, implying that it's a sensible thing to do. So, you know, I regard them almost as NPCs, you know, that term, the non-playable mm-hmm. character. You know, I think that they have been damaged so severely by the people responsible for COVID. And that's what irritates me the most, far more so than the sight of some poor old person walking around wearing the face diaper. It drives me batty to think that Dr. Fauci is walking free.
Yes.
That all the people who are responsible for all the misery, and that includes Trump, got away with it.
He gave him an award on the last day in office. He gave Fauci an award. All the people that did the warp speed operation on us, you know, they pulled a fast one on us. They didn't test anything. But of course, we all know that there wasn't any pandemic. We know that by now. You know, earlier this week, it came out that there is, you've got a lot of people who are looking at this thing and looking at the damage that's been done. There's been studies coming out of Europe talking about how there weren't any kids who died from COVID, but they're dying from heart disease from the vaccines. And at the same time, Pfizer and Moderna have had to cancel their rollout of a new COVID booster because they said they couldn't get anybody to sign up for the test. And it's like, yeah, you didn't have that problem back when Trump was president because they didn't test anything. It was fast because he skipped the testing, right? And now they, so there is a little bit of people who are waking up, but not enough. And of course, there hasn't been any consequence for the people who pulled this over on us. What is happening, as Jeffrey Tucker of Brownstone pointed out, he said, this is a cancellation by the market. And it really is a cancellation by the people. And for the most part, this ended, all this diaper madness ended because people gradually just stopped complying with it.
Exactly right. But there has yet to be accountability.
That's
a long, long time ago, when I worked at the Washington Times, I got to know Sam Francis. You're probably familiar with Sam Francis. He was sort of a paleo conservative writer. Mm-hmm. And he came up with this idea that has that resonated with me at the time. And I still refer to it often. He called it anarcho-tyranny. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by that was that for the ordinary plebs, people like you and I, and most of the people listening to this show, we'll feel the full force and effect of the law if we jaywalk. You know, if we get caught driving without a seatbelt, we're expected to obey every law and held fully accountable if we don't. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, the so-called elites, the self-appointed elites, can commit the most egregious crimes. Mm-hmm. Fauci, for example. I mean, this is a man who destroyed the lives of millions of people.
That's right.
Directly responsible for lots of death and permanent injury. Nothing happens to these people. And I think that's why we're now at this point in America where the rage is building. You know, particularly among the MAGAites, you know, the people who voted for Trump. And I was one of them. I was stupid enough. I got conned. I got rolled again. I voted for this guy, you know, and it's bad enough, you know, to have to deal with, radical leftist people but radical leftist people are going to do what they do. You know, you're not being betrayed by the radical left. They're pretty much upfront about what they're going to do to you. But
that's
it's
right.
Absolutely infuriating to be stabbed in the back by your supposed ally and friend. And I think that's why everybody, myself at any rate, are so upset about what's happening right now in the country.
And I said that back in 2020. I said, I would rather have somebody who is coming after me, you know, with a uniform and a flag, you know, they got their rainbow flag. I know exactly what they're going to try to take away from me, rather than have a traitor who's going to tell you he's behind you, and he gets behind you and he stabs you in the back. And I said, that's the way I see Trump. I said, I would rather deal with a Democrat, because then people realize who the Democrat, what his harm is, you know, how he's going to come after them. Why are the MAGA people surprised that these billionaire pedophiles are getting a free pass from the Trump administration when he gave a free pass to the people who were killing people back in 2020? You know, they saw that, they went ahead with it anyway, and now this is happening and they get angry. And I understand they should be angry, but why are they surprised that this is happening? Of course, after Trump fires Pam Bondi, the first question for Todd Blanche is, well, what are you going to do in terms of the Epstein documents and the people that committed these crimes? Well, what are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. We said if there was anybody that had done anything wrong, we would be after them. And so he's back to this, I have no idea what you're talking about. I said, when I talked about it, I said, it's very much like the Martin Short character they used to parody when he was
the lawyer on
60 Minutes,
but, you know,
the backhoe executive.
For people, because I think that ordinary people who aren't really, really disturbed mentally, have mm-hmm. difficulty understanding the mindset of people who are very disturbed, the psychopathic personality, because we sort of have an internal monitor check.
I agree.
We feel shame, guilt, remorse, empathy, these things that cause us to shy away from icky, awful things. Like, I don't want to be part of that, you know, and if I was part of it, it was inadvertent or I didn't think about it. And I'm sorry. I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
So it's hard for us to imagine a person, you know, who just doesn't care, you know, who's capable of lying to your face in the most egregious manner and then doing the most awful things and not feeling bad about it at all.
You know,
that's right.
I've mentioned that many times. You go back to Ted Bundy, right? The serial killer and rapist out there. He's such a charming, good looking guy, and he's intelligent and all the rest of stuff, but he's just pure evil. And so normal people let their guard down. They can't imagine that there's anybody like Ted Bundy, right? And that's how he gets away with it. And that's how Trump gets away with it as well.
Yeah, we thought, some of us, again, I raised my hand, mea culpa. We thought, oh, Trump got rolled in 2020, you know, by the malevolent forces that came up with this COVID operation. You know, he was out of his depth. He didn't know what he was doing. He, you know, but till, you know, now he knows. Now, you know, now he's going to do the right thing. Well, he rolled us. Is what it turned out to be.
That's right. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, when you look at what is happening, there is a perfect continuity to it, actually. You know, if you look at the bigger picture, of, you know, where these people want to go. They know that we are in a period of time, and it's kind of a natural cycle that happens. And the fourth turning, you know, many times we talk about that. And so we're in this, and we're at the very end where you typically have some massive economic issue. You have institutions are rewired and all the rest of the stuff. Frequently, there's revolutions and wars. So these people are aware of this. I mean, they use all the terminology of Strauss and Howe, talking about millennials and Gen Z and Gen X and all the rest of this stuff. But they won't talk about the fourth turning. But they're preparing and they're using the fourth turning. I think this is why we see all of the countries. I mean, it's really frightening to see what France and Germany are doing in terms of preparing for World War III. You know, they want it badly, and they are practicing mass evacuations. Of course, that's not being done here in America. We never planned on doing any civil defense. There was a plan to save themselves and let the rest of us die, and that really is the same plan here. They're not going to do any bomb shelters. Trump is freaking out because he wants them to hurry up and build his bomb shelter ballroom that's there. And so that should warn us on this side, as well as the massive buildup in terms of money that France and Germany are spending. And of course, Germany going into debt for the first time since World War II. They were always afraid to do that. But now everything is changing, and it looks like they're really trying to maneuver us into a third world war.
It's going to be interesting to see how they roll their tanks when they don't have any gas.
Yeah, that's right.
I've read.
Got to get some of that solid rocket fuel, I guess.
You know, one of the aspects of this that is not getting a lot of traction in the American news media is that in other parts of the world, you know, Australia apparently is just weeks away from having no fuel. Mm-hmm. And the situation in Europe is comparably dire. And, you know, red hats will say, well, we're here in America. We don't have to worry about that. And I point out, Doug McGregor has pointed this out as well, that in California, California imports most of its oil.
Yeah.
Where do they get their imported oil from? I've got family in Southern California. My sister and her family live there, and I was talking with my brother-in-law the other day, and they're currently paying about $6 a gallon for regular unleaded.
I had somebody on the program tell me they saw diesel at $7.79 a gallon, and that was last week.
I was going to mention that.
And Lance just said, we're only 2 weeks away.
Yeah.
The old Bibi Netanyahu line, yeah.
A lot of people who aren't familiar with this issue don't understand that diesel is actually more relevant than the price of gas, because everything that we get is moved by heavy trucks and by diesel electric locomotives and so on. And a lot of the things that are distributed throughout the United States enter the United States in California at the port of LA. Mm-hmm. And then they have to transit over California to get to the rest of the United States. So these costs, you know, we're all worried about paying a dollar plus more per gallon of the war tax every time we fill up our vehicles. But very soon, we're probably going to be paying the war tax at the supermarket as well.
You know, you picked up that term, you know, the war tax report and the date, you know, in terms of updates of that. I see that now in the mainstream media. They've caught on to what it is really. And it really is a value-added tax. It's like the VATs where they, at every stage of production, you get the tax.
Yeah, and I did some rough math, too, I think. Put it in sharper focus. The typical person who has a medium-sized crossover SUV with a 15-gallon gas tank, they are currently now having to spend close to $750 a year more than last year.
Wow!
So that means that Trump has raised taxes on average Americans more than any president that I'm aware of in the past 30 years.
Well, he was bragging about that with the tariffs, you know, because the tariffs are a tax as well.
Absolutely.
And he was bragging, I've got all this money from, you know, the taxes. And it's like, where are there any conservatives left? Do they realize that we don't want the money in the government's coffers? We want it at home. You know, we don't have any control over the federal budget. And we're not going to have any money for our household budget either if he keeps taking it for himself. He sounds just like Bernie Sanders. Look, you know, they're looting the treasury. They're going to have a tax cut or whatever. Trump is so excited because he's been accumulating all this money in his treasury. Where'd he get that money? He got it from us.
It's even more egregious, though, because at least Bernie nominally is a socialist. And, you know, supposedly, you know, he wants to help the average person. Trump is helping the billionaire class and, you know, the Wall Street class. Yeah. Look, the Dow's over 50,000, in the immortal words of now ex-Attorney General Pam Bondi.
Yeah. You know,
from their point of view, if you're among that class of people, then sure, the economy's doing gangbusters. But for the rest of us, not so much.
That's right. Yeah. When you look at who this benefits, it's going to benefit the oil companies, just like, you know, he benefited the pharmaceutical companies at our expense. He's going to benefit the oil companies. He's going to benefit the military-industrial complex at our expense. But, you know, you go back to, you know, you remember the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, right? I think you're younger than I am, but I'm sure that you remember that and the knock-on effects, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, all kinds of stuff. Now, instead of odd and even tags, they're talking about putting people on, you know, digital ID so they can fine-tune it to the individual as to when you can fill up and that type of thing. That's the insanity that we're looking at right now. They're going to use it as a means of control. People hate daylight savings time. I do too. But we had year-round daylight savings time because of the OPEC oil embargo. And this is much, much bigger than that. For Trump to say this isn't going to affect us, it just preys on the economic ignorance of his followers. I say that he's not about geopolitics. He's about ego politics. He's not about economics. He's about egonomics. And it really is true because...
I don't want to be too derogatory. He's in this bubble. You know, he's a guy clearly who wants to be surrounded by sycophants. And I was talking with somebody about this the other day. I think that the analogy that suits, and it's not because, oh, the Nazis, but Hitler was notorious for wanting yes men in his circle and would not abide anybody who was a truth teller who would tell Hitler, hey, this military thing that you're contemplating doing, invading the Soviet Union, it's a really bad idea. You know, we haven't got the depth and logistics and so on to sustain this. It's not a doable thing. You shouldn't do it because it's going to be a disaster. He'd fire that general. He'd bring in a toady, you know, who would say, yes, mein Führer, we will do it. And I think Trump's got people like that around him. Anybody who will, like, you know, Joe Kent, somebody like him who would say, Mr. President, this isn't a good idea. Here's why. You're a traitor. You're disloyal. You're out.
That's right. We all know that. Yeah. As a matter of fact,
so he's got an echo chamber. He's got people telling him he's the greatest, most beautiful thing ever. And so he thinks he is.
There was a clip where they had members of the cabinet or whatever in public, speaking in public. And I think it was Stephen Miller who went first. And he does this flowery, sycophant, flattering speech to Trump about how great he is about this, how great he is about that. And then he finishes and Trump says, well, that's pretty good. Let's see if you can do better than that. And he pointed to another member, and I forget who that was. And they start out the same type of thing. This is the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. This is why they're so dysfunctional, quite frankly.
Yeah, he's every day you think, okay, that's as far as they can go. They can't possibly go even farther. Now they're talking about putting his image, I think, on the $100 bill or something like that. Have you heard about that?
It's a commemorative coin. Yeah, they've got a 24-karat gold coin, at least that they want to put his face on. And then for the money, I think that's what you're talking about, put his signature on there, which the president hasn't done in the past, has not signed the bill, but he wants to put his signature on. I hope it's... I remember he had his signature on that birthday card in a very strategic place.
Well, this is just a little bit vulgar. It's indicative of a guy who's kind of low class.
That's right.
But it's transgressed that now to the point of it's pathological. Yeah. There's something not right with him in the mind because, you know, and it may have something to do too with him perhaps beginning to show stages of advanced or beginning senility. Because any normal person would, if they even had that impulse, would restrain that impulse in their mind. They would realize this is going to make me look like
a maniac.
I'm not going to do that. Even though I want to, I'm not going to do it.
I think when he puts his signature on the bill, I think you're going to have some people make up some stamps. You know, back in the day, the people I knew in the Libertarian Party who had stamps that... You could stamp the dollar bill, and it was George Washington. What it would do is put out a little dialogue bubble there and say, I grew hemp. And so I can imagine people getting a stamp that matches up with Trump's signature and recreate that female hourglass shape that he used and stamp that over his signature. Put that on the currency that's there just to remind people who he is.
it's horrendous, you know, and as much as we, you know, bandy it about and find some humor in it, it's really quite ominous the way things are going. Now, what are we not even a day away from the next obliteration to follow the previous obliteration?
Yeah, I know. And when you look at what happened over the holiday weekend, You know, he becomes this F-bombing terrorist. the vulgarity as well as the stupidity of this stuff. And I hate, you get to a situation where you got even people like Emmanuel Macron who sound rational compared to Trump. He says, maybe you don't talk every day because every day you say something and the next day you say something that's exactly the opposite. You need to get serious, is what he said. Yeah. And I think he's serious.
He's being made to look like a loser. And that for Trump is absolutely intolerable.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that he's not going to step back and dial it down. I think he's going to increase it and ratchet things up.
That's right.
And the thing is, the Iranians have shown they're fully capable of escalating in turn. So where does this lead us? Where do we go?
That's right. Yeah, he's definitely drained.
Maniacs to start lobbing nukes at Iran. Then it's probably all over for all of us.
Yeah. Well, he has guaranteed that they're going to have nuclear weapons because he has shown that if you don't have nuclear weapons, you are vulnerable to attack from the United States for any reason whatsoever, right? And that's the only way that you're going to be safe is if you've got nuclear weapons. So he's made it clear that they're going to get nuclear weapons now, regardless. We've been told by Netanyahu they're always just 2 weeks away, right? Well, they're going to get them now. And that's going to be on Trump and Netanyahu for doing that.
And can you blame them? You know,
no, I don't. Yeah.
To the Iranians. You know, if you see a guy or you know a guy who's getting constantly beaten up by a bigger guy, would you blame that guy for going to the gym and maybe learning some Krav Maga?
Yes,
right. You know, and going back and kicking the bully's butt in return? I wouldn't blame the guy for doing that.
Or go back and get a pistol or something like that. That's really probably, if we're going to talk about going to nuclear weapons, that would be the better analogy that the guy comes up and starts to hit him and he blows him away. That's the shame. And as they're looking at the people that are there, of course, if he wanted regime change, there's already a lot of dissent there in Iran. He just shut all that down.
Yep.
Now the great Satan is America, not the Ayatollah. And he just underscored that with his message over the holiday weekend saying, praise Allah. Well, if that didn't if they didn't get the message before, they certainly got it with that, didn't they? And one of the things that sets me off, Eric, is I hate to see these people who talk about 47. I even saw this video that some guy put up on social media saying, this is prophetic. You realize that Trump is 47th president, right? And they've been after us for 47 years. It all fits, you know. It's like, you idiot, you don't even know when all the U.S.-Iranian stuff began. It began 73 years ago. It began in 1953. We overthrew their elected government, and we put in a despot king and trained a ruthless secret police force, the Savak. I knew about that before the Iranians took over the U.S. embassy because we had a lot of Iranian students that were going to USF where I was and taking engineering classes. And these guys were protesting the Shah. They were doing it with balaclavas over their faces. I said, what are you guys doing that for? I said, well,
it is a tragedy that so many Americans know absolutely nothing about the outside world or the actions of the U.S. government vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And they have this cartoonish image of America as the great writer of wrongs against all these benighted third world people, who are out to take away our freedoms. It's absurd.
Where do they get that image? That's crafted for them by the CIA running through Fox News and the New York Post and mainstream media for the most part.
So you end up with this juvenile solipsistic view of the world where you can't step out of your own shoes and look at it from somebody else's point of view. And you can't do that if you don't have the facts. As you say, you know, most Americans are unaware of the fact that the CIA deposed the legitimate leader of Iran and imposed upon the Iranian people this awful person, the Shah, who used his secret police to brutalize the people. And the backlash to that was the Islamic Revolution. That's
right.
Why there was an Islamic Revolution. That's why we got the Ayatollah Khomeini. And that's why they did all the things that they did. And they don't trust us. And they don't like us, or at least our government. And it's understandable why they don't.
Well, it's amazing when you look at it. You know, our government basically created the Ayatollah as a blowback from what they were doing. And then when you look at all the different terrorist organizations, right, they start out with a Mujahideen that they're going to use against Russia and Afghanistan. And then that morphs into Al-Qaeda, that morphs into ISIS and into al-Nusra and so forth. The next thing you know, at the tail end of it, we are supporting those guys in terms of overthrowing Assad in Syria. And so we put in one of the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, al-Nusra guys to run Syria. And he goes on this killing campaign, killing Christians and Alawite minority and all the rest of that stuff. And so that's what the policy of the U.S. government has been, to foment war, chaos, and disorder. And that's what's happening right now in Iran. They wanted regime change. Well, you got it. Mission accomplished, I guess, except you made the regime worse. And it always does that with civilian bombing campaigns.
I think there's a silver lining to this otherwise very dark cloud, though, and it is that the people see. Not all of them. You know, mm-hmm. there's still a cohort of the red hat crowd that doesn't see it. But by and large, most Americans, regardless of their political affiliations, do see it. This war is extremely unpopular. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, Americans, you know, I talk to a lot of people. I've got a lot of friends who've got draft age kids. They don't want their kids going over there to kill and be killed potentially over this idiocy. No. They want nothing to do with it. You know, the whole rah-rah, yay America stuff that we saw back during the war on terror and George W. Bush and all of that, that's not here now.
Yeah.
At least not according to what I can tell.
That's right.
That's good.
I tell you, it's like deja vu all over again, you know. Like Vietnam and the unpopularity of Lyndon Johnson and everything, the convention that's coming up and the oil embargo is like, I said, the only thing worse is if they bring back disco music.
Something else is better. Did you catch Karen Katowski's piece on Lou Rockwell today?
No, I didn't see it. What was it?
Well, she made the point, and I thought this was very observant, that the other salutary thing that's happened already is that we've seen that this colossus, this defense industry, and all of our fancy toys are essentially useless wastes of money.
Yeah.
You know, all of these advanced weapon systems that we're forced to pay for through our taxes are obsolete. They're garbage. They're junk. So are we spending money on all this stuff when it obviously doesn't work?
That's right.
And, you know, maybe it will be able to somehow dial back the so-called Defense Department as a result of this.
Well, I don't know. They'll just have a new round of killing machines or whatever. But I've talked about it many times. It was something that actually Lance showed me in the book. It was called Kill Decision. And it was by, what's the name of that guy, Lance?
Daniel Suarez.
And that was about a decade or so ago, was it? Maybe longer. And he kind of war-gamed this whole thing out in terms of swarms of drones being the thing that equalizes and takes out even like aircraft carrier groups and stuff. And so that's kind of where we are right now. And you know, spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear the ending of the book, but the bottom line is it was a threat that was created by the military-industrialized complex so they could obsolete all of these expensive weapon systems and sell a complete new line, or, you know, a version 2.0. But that's what we're seeing right now. When you look at the way this war is being conducted, the only people who are doing it right are the Iranians. There was a guy, if I remember his name correctly, is Robert Pape, I think. And he wrote, he did a study after Vietnam War saying, you know, why is it that we lost? You know, we look at how many bombs were dropped in Vietnam. We still wound up losing that. You know, that is the metric that we keep hearing from War Pete's Pentagon all the time. Well, look at how many bombs we dropped. We got to be winning, you know, with all this kind of stuff. And I think it was General McGregor Colonel McGregor who said, that's the same kind of nonsense we heard in Vietnam, and it didn't work then. It's not working now. So this guy looked at it, and he said, when I went back and I looked at the Korean War, it was even worse. And he said, and yet we lost that one as well. So I thought, you know, what is it about these air campaigns that are not working? He wound up writing a book called Bombing to Win. And his point was, if you go in with these massive bomb strategies to just turn everything to dust, he said, that doesn't work. He said, what does work is to go tactically after the enemy's warfighting equipment, right? Which is what we see Iran doing. You know, they're strategically going in and attacking central radar points and so forth like that to take away the enemy's ability to conduct the war. And that demoralizes people. It doesn't demoralize them to bomb the civilian population. As a matter of fact, it strengthens morale to push back against that injustice. And the Pentagon just hasn't gotten that message.
Yep. These are not benighted Bedouins. Mm-hmm. You know, Iran is a huge country and it's a very mountainous country. And, mm-hmm. and very clearly, they have been preparing for this eventuality for quite some time.
Yep.
Apparently, they have got these underground cities where they've got all these drones and missiles and stuff that are essentially immune to any attack from the air.
That's right.
And so what do we do? You know, and now Trump apparently is going to send in thousands of Marines to capture Karg Island, which will probably result in thousands of American casualties.
Yeah.
And then what? You know, after another embarrassing humiliation, not to mention the body count, what's he going to do?
Yeah.
He's going to escalate.
Yeah.
You know, and in his fury and demented rage, maybe he's going to launch a nuke, or maybe he'll allow or egg on the Israelis to do it.
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, that is the plan, though. You know, I mean, the Israelis want to do to Iran what they did to Gaza. Their strategy to get the what they call Greater Israel, which is everything from the Nile to the Euphrates, their strategy is to completely annihilate everybody else and then move in and, you know, take over the corpse of the land that's left behind. That's what they're doing in Gaza. That's what they want to do to Iran. And that's what they want to do to all the Gulf states. And they know that if they continue egging on the U.S. and if Trump's ego lands and does that, then the Iranians are going to respond by attacking other Gulf states. And so they will decimate the other Gulf states as well and do the work for them. I think that is the long plan. I think it's a big real estate deal for Kushner.
One thing they perhaps have not thought through is that they are bankrupting the sympathy account.
Yeah,
you know, by and large, people are turning against the state of Israel, and they're no longer equating criticism of what the state of Israel does with anti-Jewish hostility. You know, people are making that distinction, and thank God for that.
Yeah,
you know, it's not, you know, you're not. They can throw out that whole anti-Semite thing. Well, I don't hate people who happen to be Jewish. I do hate Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
I do hate Bibi Netanyahu. He's an evil man. I think that he should be arrested and put in prison for the rest of his life, if not something else.
And there's a lot of Jews that agree with you as well. Yeah, and there's a lot of people in Israel that say the same thing, you know. I mean, we go back and we look at what Netanyahu did during COVID. He offered his people up as a sacrifice to Pfizer so they could get the front of the list. If they get the front of the list and they get people nominally vaccinated, now they can travel and so forth and so on. And he offered them, he said, you don't have any data. Use my people for that, right? I mean, he's got absolutely no concern for his own people, just like Trump doesn't.
Yep. And people see it now.
Yeah.
They've had enough of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're talking about the war tax. You're talking about not only what it cost you to fill up the tank, but of course, how this is going to percolate out into all these other different aspects, from food to you name it, you know, even plastic containers, right? We can't get the petroleum products. But you also talked about how the rising costs of everything have basically shut out the upcoming generation from being able to get cars and homes and that type of thing, right?
Yeah, there was a very depressing and infuriating commercial I saw the other day that was put forth by Uber that was romanticizing what I consider to be dependency and perpetual childhood. It
really?
Showed a young couple, you know, and instead of the guy going to pick up his date in a car, he gets out of the backseat of the Uber, you know, and the two of them get driven somewhere, just like you know, when you were in eighth grade, you know, your mom and dad drove you to the junior prom, and they're presenting this as somehow, you know, this is cool. This is what you should do. And, you know, it is nothing less than a tragedy that rising generation of kids finds that even something that we took for granted, you and I, when we were that age, you know, having your first car might've been something of a jalopy, but you could afford it. It was yours. You know, and you were able to go out and pick your friends up or your girlfriend up and go and have some fun. And you were, even at 16, a proto-adult, you know, in
yeah,
a very real, real and meaningful way. Now, you know, these 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds might as well be 12-year-olds, you know, because they're just stuck. They're dependent on their parents to take them places or a bus or a train.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they stay at home until they're 30 because they can't afford to move out of the house. Some of them are still there at 40. You know, it's awful. No wonder they're angry. And no wonder, and this is what I dread, that, you know, we're going to end up with some sort of leftist backlash out of resentment and rage and fury at a system. And they're going to blame, ironically, they're going to blame capitalism for it, as if capitalism created this situation, which, of course, it didn't.
Yeah, it all gets back to the liberty of mobility stuff as well, you know, because you know, used to be able to, that was the big thing that I'd look forward to. I mean, when I was a kid, I was looking forward first to getting a bike. That's going to give me some extended range here. Right?
Yeah.
And then as you start to get older, it's like, well, let's see, I could get a motorcycle, except mom's not going to let me do that. That would give me a lot of independence. So I had to wait till I got a car. But, you know, by the time I'm 16, yeah, you're out there and you're able to do things like that. Now they're looking. And of course, this latest, the Trump oil embargo, which is what I like to call it, instead of the OPEC, we got Trump. And so now the Trump oil embargo is going to be locking everybody down to work from home. You got five countries now that have mandated that for their government employees, and some of them have gone a little bit further than that, as well as doing rationing of filling up of gas and all the things that we lived through in the 1970s. All these evil things are coming back. But this work from home and don't travel, you know, stay locked at home. This is going back to the same MacGuffin that we've had. They've tried this now. This is the third way that they've done this. They've done it by telling everybody, you can't have any energy because we're going to burn the planet down with CO2, right? Then that was the climate MacGuffin. Then they did the COVID MacGuffin, saying you got to stay at home because we're all going to die, you know, put on your mask and so forth. Now we've got another MacGuffin, which is, although it's a real problem this time, it is something that Trump created.
Yep. And the thing is, this time they may not even have to do it overtly because it'll have been done economically.
That's right.
Right now, at current prices, if you've got a full-size truck or SUV, it's going to cost you about $110 to fill the tank up. Who can afford that?
I know. Yeah.
You know, even if you're driving a smaller vehicle, it's still $60. You know, to fill up the tank. And that's just not sustainable. It's not supportable. And by the way, you know, an aspect of that that hasn't been talked about much that I think is important, GM and Ford, particularly, their profits depend almost entirely on the sale of big SUVs and trucks. What do you suppose is going to happen to the market when it costs $150 to fill up the tank of a pickup truck? They're going to be unsellable. That's They're right. just going to sit there, and it's going to cause General Motors and Ford to go bankrupt again.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, I'm just telling you, we're celebrating our 54th anniversary of our first date, and we're talking about how much it costs to fill up a tank of gas. And I said, yeah, you know, back in the day, we would, you know, for $20, I could fill up the gas tank. I could take Karen to the movies as well as dinner for two and still have some change left over. It's crazy what's happened to our money. It's crazy the inflation that's there. And of course, these are real increases in terms of, it's what you talk about in your article, in terms of, you know, the price going up. The car is about six times more expensive than it was when you first got your car. Homes are about four plus times more expensive than when you got your first home. So this is the kind of degradation of our lifestyle that these people are. It's the way they get us to the point where we own nothing. And they tell us that we're going to be happy with that. But I don't think people are going to be happy.
You know, I don't like the term inflation because I think it's dishonest. It's deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And I've got an example that I think makes the point very well. As you know, I've got my 76 Trans Am, and I've had that car for more than 30 years. I was able to buy that car when I was a young guy, still in my 20s. And I was able to drive it regularly because it only cost $20 to fill that thing up. Now, and I bought the car at a time when I also had a mortgage. I was able to buy my first house around the same time. I can barely afford to drive that same car today, you know, and I'm twice as old.
Yeah.
And you know, the point is my ability to buy things has been diminished to that extent. And the only reason I'm still able to indulge the Trans Am is because I bought it 30 years ago. There's no way I could afford to buy a car like that today. And, you know, again, I can barely afford to drive it, notwithstanding that at this point in my life, I should be more able to afford a car like that and more able to feed it. And I don't have a mortgage right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's how bad it's gotten.
Well, I think Trump is going to accelerate this and send us down the hill really fast, because when you look at what he's doing, and also Biden kicked this off in terms of destroying the petrodollar, you know, they're really pouring gasoline on that fire. And once they do that, and once we are exposed to the full liability of this $40 trillion deficit, you know, Trump complains all the time about the trade deficit, but the one that really is an emergency is the budget deficit. He never talks about that. Neither does the Republican Party. Only Thomas Massey talks about that. And so that's going to be the thing that's really going to affect all of our lives, because that credit card bill is going to come due on Mr. and Mrs. America real soon, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up the point about the petrodollar, because that is the thing that really counts as far as what's going on over in the Middle East. The Iranians and all these other countries are beginning to transact in other than dollars.
That's right.
You know, the Iranians are now exporting more oil and getting more money for it, and they're going to get paid in other than dollars.
That's right.
And, you know, when that when that whole thing comes to complete fruition, it will totally destroy the dollar and its power. And almost immediately, overnight, we're going to find ourselves, you think inflation's bad now, it's devaluation. Whatever money we still have, we'll be able to buy even less.
That's right.
And, you know, I guess at that point, you know, desperate people, once they have completely insurfed, they've already insurfed the working income people. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to insurf middle income people. And then they're going to have achieved what they want, which is this society in which, you know, 2 or 3% at the very top pretty much have everything and everybody else has nothing.
That's right.
That's what they're after.
That's right. And that is the Trump class society. We should call that the Trump society, because that's it. You know, they live in their high rise, gilted skyscrapers, and the rest of us just scrape by, you know,
They're not even putting a slight facade on it. You remember back during the Carter era when Jimmy Carter at least had the decency to put a sweater on? Remember that?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to turn down the thermostat because I know it costs a lot to keep the heat on. Trump overtly says, I don't care. He literally says, I don't care what people are paying for gas or anything else. And of course he doesn't care. Why should he?
That's right.
You know, it doesn't affect him.
And part of the lie is that everything is going to somehow snap back to normal as soon as he's decided he's won the war. Well, it's not going to snap back to normal. We are still suffering from the insanity that he inflicted on us 6 years ago with the COVID MacGuffin. Things Absolutely. Are not going to come back right away. I mean, even if he had just messed up the supply lines like he did 6 years ago, but they are destroying production capacity. You can get your shipping stuff going, but they're not going to have anything to ship once they blow up all the oil refineries. And these things, it's like a tinderbox over there. He's not going to be happy until he set the entire Mideast on fire, because that's what the Israelis want.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
And I think that realization is beginning to percolate. And, you know, Americans are asking the question, what's in it for me? Like, what is the benefit to me of all of this? And they're realizing, and there isn't. And there are a lot of liabilities and people are tired of it. The question is, you know, what next? What do we do? Do we have any recourse? And I guess my biggest worry at this moment is that Trump actually has gamed this all out.
Yep.
Because you'd think that purely from a cynical point of view, you know, he understands there's a midterm election not that far away now. And that not only would that mean potentially he's politically neutered, but, you know, if there's a big backlash and the House and the Senate end up in the hands of the Democrats, that he might face more than just an impeachment this time.
That's right.
Maybe he doesn't care because he knows there aren't going to be midterms.
Yeah.
Maybe he's going to declare an emergency like he did back in 2020.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'll become our Zelensky, El Presidente for life, or at least as long as his diabetes or whatever else is wrong with him doesn't catch up to him.
Well, that would definitely kick off the revolution that I think both sides want. If he cancels the elections. But, of course, you saw the clip of CPAC, didn't you? Where the guy who's running the thing gets up there and says,
impeachment.
yeah. How many of you want to see impeachment? Yay, impeachment. Said, no, wrong answer. I thought for a moment they'd come to their senses.
In a cult. You know, one of the most striking things about current events right now is that you've got this strange juxtaposition. You know, during the COVID years, people were pointing out how the people on the left were in a cult. They were wearing their masks and they were performing rituals, just like people in a cult.
Yeah.
Now you've got people who are on the right who are criticizing those people, and they're in a cult.
That's right.
You know, their cult leader is Trump. And whatever Trump says, it's received truth from Mount Sinai. It must be so.
Yeah, that's right. It's either a Trump derangement or Trump delusion. There's two different sides of this. But I think it's kind of interesting. When you look at, I've seen some people getting back to cars. I've seen some people say, well, now electric vehicles are going to have their day. And it's like, well, how are you going to be able to afford that? Number one. Number two, are you going to be able to afford the electricity? We're going to see electricity skyrocket in price, not just fuel. That's coming down the pike. And, you know, it's when you look at what Trump's focused on, and this really ought to scare people, his number one priority is artificial intelligence. And that's why I think, you know, the argument, I think, you know, when you look, is Trump evil or just stupid? I want to flip over to the evil side. I think he really is Dr. Evil, because that is the plan to dominate all of us. And that has been his focus from the very beginning of this administration, even more so than the crypto stuff. And of course, the crypto comes with controls as well. If he switches us over to a stablecoin environment, that's basically a privatized CBDC. So these people can make their cut on it. But when you look at the AI stuff, his very first day, He's out there talking about how they're going to use AI to custom make genetic code injections for us with mRNA. And now there's talk about how, well, the AI data centers are going to have some anti-drone guns that are going to be driven by artificial intelligence. They're going to be able to find the targets and take them out. That was the same kind of defense system, by the way, that Israel had on their wall on October the 7th. And either it didn't work too well or somebody shut it down. But they're saying, we got to protect the AI data centers. They're not going to protect our they're not going to protect our infrastructure. They're not going to protect our electricity. They're going to protect the electricity of the brain that is going to be used to spy on us and to control us. That's what they're focused on. From the very beginning, when Trump had that Stargate thing, he said, well, you know, you guys are going to want to build your own data centers because, you know, our infrastructure is getting pretty old and it's unreliable and everything. And I said on that day, I said, you hear that? He says the infrastructure is awful and he's not going to do anything to fix it. They're just going to let it crumble. And that's what he's now saying. He's, hey, we can't do anything with the welfare state or help people with Medicare or anything. We got wars to fight. That's what we want to do.
And yeah, I had a bad feeling and I should have paid more attention to my bad feeling. When was it? Within the first week after his inauguration, he had that press conference with Altman and Ellison and that other guy. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Stargate, yeah. And that was a guy from the Japanese guy from SoftBank in Japan, yeah.
And they do tell us, you know, they do telegraph what their intentions are. And sometimes we just, I guess, don't want to see it. And that was a case of I didn't want to see it. Okay, maybe, you know, whatever. It's not a big deal. It was a big deal.
It's a Ted Bundy moment.
His priorities. Yeah. Those were his priorities. And then, you know, another thing about these data centers that's really aggravating to me, they're popping up now in small town rural areas. And the local people are getting to pay higher property taxes and everything else as a result of this. You know, they're coming in and eminent domaining people's farms, land to put up these things because, oh, they're going to get more tax revenue from the data center.
Yeah, that's right. And then it's this 24/7 noise and light show, you know, that's going on. But the whole thing is being used. They've been saving data for decades, right? I remember when the NSA opened up that big data center out in Bluffdale, Utah. And it's like, why are they putting it out in the desert where they need to have so much water as well as electricity? But, building these big centers to save everything. And I was talking to William Binney, who is the global technical head for the NSA for quite a while and became a whistleblower. But, he said they're saving everything on everybody. They don't have the technology yet to go through all of it. Well, they do now. Right. They're going to start using AI to audit everybody, you know, just like they used it to audit for the Doge system. Right. And just as we've seen Trump use it to audit the real estate transactions of his enemies, they're going to use it for everything.
It's harrowing. Like, you know, Vyshinsky, who was the Soviet judge in Nuremberg and also the guy who presided over the show trials earlier in the Soviet Union, is reported to have said, you know, show me the man and I'll show you the crime.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and that's essentially what this is. They'll dig through your records. They'll find something. You know, maybe you posted a mean tweet 10 years ago and now it's run afoul of the speech code and they can dredge that up and go after you for it.
That's right.
You know, it's truly a horrible thing. If you can imagine living in a world where literally everything that you do is known to these malevolent authorities that are just looking for a pretext, some reason, something that they can nail you for. We're not talking about moral crimes. We're talking about these technical crimes, which are legion now. It's kind of like you get pulled over for a seatbelt violation or some other nonsense that has nothing to do with any harm you've caused to anybody, but it's against the law. It's a violation. Well, they're erecting scores of violations, and we all commit violations all the time.
That's right.
The thing is, we've been able to get away with it because there hasn't been up till now this panopticon where they know everything you do the moment that you do it. Well, soon that's going to be the scenario, and it makes me want to run in the woods.
That's right.
And just live in there.
That's what Harvey Silverglate said a while ago. He said, three felonies a day. He said, all of us are committing three felonies a day. We just don't know it, right? Because the law has become so complex and so pervasive on every particular topic. And so now they'll be able to go back and audit us. It's the same kind of thing they did with Martha Stewart, right? She didn't get convicted for insider trading. She got convicted because she said something that was, let's say, marginally untrue to the FBI, and they caught her in a contradiction. And that's the hallmark of what these lawfare cases are about. They want to get people into a situation, put them under oath, so they can find some discrepancy and come after them for that you know, for committing perjury, which is the bigger crime. We see that happening over and over again. And of course, that's the key part about the income tax. Sign this under threat of perjury. And so if you go back and find anything on your income tax that isn't quite right, they can come after you for that type of thing. It's a perfect process crime to be able to go back and audit people with artificial intelligence for their tax reports, tax returns. Yeah.
And they're also going to be able to leverage economics. You know, during COVID, I, of course, ignored the lockdown orders. And mm-hmm. I go out and I specifically went downtown to go to the regional hospital to have a look for myself using my own eyes to see whether there were lines forming out in front and whether there were corpses stacking up outside. In other words, to prove to myself that it was just not happening and that, you know, this was all hyped and exaggerated. Well, fast forward to now, you know, you're driving your connected car mm-hmm. that emits telemetry about your movements, where you are. Mm-hmm. So they know that you violated a lockdown. And mm-hmm. maybe they don't shut you down necessarily as far as your ability to drive, though they could do that, but they will shut down your ability to buy.
That's right.
Because everything will be digitized. So then you go to the store after you commit your heretical act by driving somewhere where you're supposedly not allowed to go, and you find that your digitized dollars don't work. You know, you've been precluded from buying anything as punishment for having transgressed the other rule. That's where we're headed.
That's right. That's absolutely right. They started doing that with the climate MacGuffin, you know, saying, well, you know, you're going to destroy the planet if you travel too much or you have too much meat to eat and that type of thing. So we got to track all that stuff and keep an inventory of that. It is a total panopticon of surveillance. And that's really what these data centers are about. It's one of the reasons why Trump is making sure that there's not going to be any state legislation to stop them. You know, they are adamant that they're going to control it solely from Washington. And to say that is to say there's not going to be any control. It'll be just like it is with the pharmaceutical companies. I played the clip of Woody Harrelson 3 years ago when he went on Saturday Night Live, and he said, they gave me this movie script. I went out into Central Park, sat down and start reading it. And he goes, so that you won't believe this movie script. And he says, you get all the biggest drug cartels get together and form one group, and they buy up all the media companies and everything. And they force everybody to take their drug and keep forcing them to take it over and over again. I set it down. I said, that's too unbelievable. Nobody would believe that. Well, he had to do that on Saturday Night Live, because if he did it on a recorded program, the network would shut him down, because the network has been bought by the big pharmaceutical companies. That's why he did it on live TV. So, you know, that's really where we are right now. And these people are going to be watching everything that we do and shutting us down in real time. And Trump is fully on board with that. He's clearing the decks to make sure that the digital surveillance police state is right there. And I think that's a big part of what's going on with ICE. It's not so much about the immigration thing as it is about creating a federalized police force that's going to be characterized by excessive force.
And normalizing the sight. Mm-hmm. You know, Americans are getting used to, just like, you know, people are now used to when they fly, having mm-hmm. to deal with these government goons rifling through their possessions and touching them.
Yeah.
You know, which is something that never would have been conceivable to, mm-hmm. to Americans who have the memory to recall what this country was like before there was such a thing as the TSA. Nobody right. touched you. Nobody, right. you know, you had to be a criminal before an authority figure would lay hands on you. Now it's been routinized.
That's right.
Well, now it's being routinized to see these body armored, you know, automatic weapon toting people. And not only that they can just grab people and yeah. throw them into the back of a van and take them somewhere. That's yeah. being normalized.
Well, they wear the mask. There's your diaper report, right? the masked ICE agents that are out there. And the other thing too, talk about delusion. All the people when, you know, TSA wasn't getting paid because the government is so dysfunctional, they can't even pay their own goons. And then everybody's saying, we got to get them paid somehow because we got to be able to travel. Instead of saying, yeah, let's get rid of the TSA. We don't need it. Instead of saying that, they say, how are we going to get these guys paid? This is horrible. I need my security police back. You know, it's like, give me back my security blanket.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible. And, you know, I think Americans, though, are beginning to be aware of what's going on. So the question then becomes, what do we do? How mm-hmm. do we fight mm-hmm. this?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, facing it is the first step. Being aware, being realistic with yourself about what we're up against is important. And maybe the next thing to do is just to withdraw your consent. As a lot of classical libertarians mm-hmm. would say, just don't go along with it. At least in your head, reject it. and do everything you can to not be involved with it.
I've never been more sure of anything in my life than the nonsense of the TSA. And when we look at the reactions of people, it's very much like your story there, your diaper report about the woman who's riding in the car by herself, the windows rolled up, and she's got a mask on, right? But that's the way the people are at the airport. I need my TSA security mask back on me, you know, because I'm not safe from terrorists otherwise. And, you know, there was, you remember right after they rolled out the naked body scanners and started doing pat downs and everything, there was an organized boycott for the following Thanksgiving. And on the busiest travel day of the year, the TSA just shut it down, everything, and said, go on through, because everybody was going to opt out and force them to pat everybody down and was going to make a point about showing resistance. So rather than letting people show their resistance to it, they just shut the whole system down. And subsequent to that, we found a lawsuit that was filed, and they, by mistake, put up the full lawsuit and without redactions. Then realized a mistake and later took that down and put up the one with redactions. But we got both of them and we compared them. And you could see that they were saying in 2011, 10 years after 9/11, that there was no threat to airports or airplanes. And of course, we know that because they fail 95% of the time. So if there was a threat, there would have been some more incidents, but it's just not happening. And so that's where we are right now. But let's talk a little bit about EVs, because you got an interesting story. 51 new cases is the title of your article at EP Autos. And you're talking about the Nissan Leaf. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, there's another incident, another series of cases of spontaneous combustion, this time involving new or nearly new Nissan Leafs, supposedly because of a manufacturing defect. So there's been a recall because 51 of them have caught fire. The thing is, though, it's much more than merely the manufacturing defect, because EVs are inherently fire prone by the nature of high voltage lithium ion batteries, as we all know. There have been EV fires involving, I think, pretty much every make and model of EV that's currently available, because that's what you get with lithium ion batteries. And that's what you get with, you know, involving yourself with extremely high voltage, 400, 800 volt architecture, and the charging process. And one of the things about this that I think is very interesting and just hasn't been discussed often enough is the fact that, you know, over time, even if everything's ideal and you've got this very well-constructed electric vehicle battery case, over time in a motor vehicle, you know, it's going to get jostled. It's going to get vibrated. You're going to hit potholes. You're going to have extremes of heat in the summertime. You're going to have extremes of cold in the wintertime. And that degrades materials over time. Any engineer will tell you that, you know, and it over time results in that system becoming less stable and more prone to developing a problem. And if you've ever looked inside an electric vehicle battery pack, it's a lattice. It's this gigantic lattice, very complex structure of all these little bits and pieces. And when they begin to deteriorate and fray, then you get a short circuit out of one of the individual cells. There are thousands of cells in that EV battery pack. All it takes is one of those things to develop a little hairline crack or fissure in it, and boom, you know, you get this cascading thermal runaway event and a horrendous fire that happens almost immediately, not just a little fizzle, fire, extremely high temperature fire. And this is something that is inherently dangerous. You know, you look back at the Pinto, you and I can remember the Pinto, and there was a big hullabaloo about the Pinto sometimes catching fire. If it got rear-ended, you had to hit the thing from behind really hard to sever the fuel filler neck, which not only caused the gas to spill, but it created a spark because the metal went shh like that, you know, and there was a spark and boom. EVs just catch fire just sitting there. There wasn't a single case of a single Pinto just catching fire just sitting there. So, you know, even a Pinto is inherently more safe than any EV because, you know, you need the gas in the first place to spill, to leak, to have the vapors. And then you have to have the second compounding factor, the spark that will ignite. Whereas with EVs, they just spontaneously combust, and there's nothing that you can do to prevent that from happening.
And you pointed out in your article that there were only 38 cases of the Pinto, and yet there's 51 cases of this one particular model that they got as part of the recall. And so you start with that, and then you point out the fact that, well, you know, why is it being recalled? Well, they think that during the manufacturing process, some of these batteries got bumped slightly. And that has caused something that could short circuit and cause it to spontaneous combust like that. But I remember first time I ever heard of an electric vehicle burning down a house was when I was living in North Carolina, and it was a home in Charlotte. and the people just charging it at their house. They had it in the garage, and it spontaneously combusted and burnt the entire house down. And but since then, you know, we've seen pictures. I remember seeing pictures of Nevi in a parking garage just explode, you know, because they had the monitoring cameras there. We've seen it happen with buses on the street, and you've had situations where after it happened, the one video that I played, it was in France, and it spontaneously combusted. The bus did burn very, very rapidly. And subsequent to that, you had a couple of situations like that with at bus stations in Germany, two different locations. One was in Stuttgart, the other was in Munich, I think. And one of them caught fire, and it was so intense that it burned all of them down. And yep. So after that, some municipalities in Canada said, well, we're going to switch out our electric buses and go back to diesel. But it is inherent in the technology. And if you think about it, it's a lot more fragile than a Pinto. And that's the other issue. You know, if there's just a, during the manufacturing or the shipping of the component part, if a bump can cause a defect in the battery, what does a car accident cause? And we've heard cases after cases of a car accident. And if you're unfortunately in a Tesla, those things are under software control in terms of opening the doors. So you get locked into the thing as it's spontaneously combusting. Yeah.
Yeah. And how about the two container ships that went down?
That's right.
You know, they were transporting EVs. They were just transporting them. These were not plugged into anything. They were just sitting, and they caught fire and took the whole ship out.
Yeah.
This is a disaster. And, you know, it's a disaster that has a ripple effect on people who have nothing to do and want nothing to do with EVs. You and I and everybody else are getting to pay more for car insurance and for home insurance because of the actual and potential costs incurred by these EVs and the fires. One of the cases that is particularly glaring was a case of this this couple that lived in Maryland, I believe it was. And they took their vehicle into the Mercedes-Benz dealership for service, their vehicle, which was not an EV, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the dealer gave them a Mercedes EV loaner car, mm-hmm. and they drove the thing home, and they parked it in their driveway outside of their garage, wasn't plugged in, and they just left it sitting there. Well, the thing caught fire. Not only did it burn to the ground, it burned their house to the ground. And these were affluent people. They had a home that was worth about $1 million. Mm. Who do you think pays for that? We do.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Does that come under the car insurance or the homeowner's insurance? I wonder which one of that is. But yeah, it is crazy. But, you know, it is it's something that people are still fanatical about. You point out a Jalopnik article where they were talking about bemoaning the fact that Rolls-Royce is going to still sell their V12 engine. They couldn't believe that they weren't going to go completely EV. Talk a little bit about that.
That one got under my skin because, after all, I am a car journalist, which means at least it used to mean that you're somebody who not only likes cars but understands them.
Yeah.
And you know, my profession now is suffused with people who have no understanding, no comprehension whatsoever of cars.
And a lot of them work at Jalopnik.
And they work at, not just that, unfortunately, Road and Track and Car and Driver too.
Yeah.
They're so blinkered. They don't see that a person who's in a position to buy something like a Rolls or a Bentley, you know, they want something that isn't just another device. Mm-hmm. You're spending $250,000 on a vehicle. You want something that's exclusive. Well, I hate to break it to you, but a battery pack isn't exclusive.
That's right.
You know, a Hyundai has a battery pack. Not that there's anything wrong with a Hyundai. I'm just pointing out that it's a battery pack. Mm-hmm. There's nothing special about it. You know, nobody oohs and ahs. Ooh, my battery pack has 80 kilowatt hours, you know, versus that one over there. That one only has 63 kilowatt hours. It's ridiculous. Whereas V12, now that's got some gravitas. That's got some heft.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're, you know, in traffic and you glance over at that car next to you and it has the chrome letters and it says V12, you go, wow, that's impressive. And even more impressive when you look at it and you hear it. What do you hear with a battery pack? You hear nothing. You know, you push the start button. It's like putting a turning on the light switch in your room. Okay, whatever. I mean, it turns on.
Yeah.
There's no passion. There's no feeling. There's nothing there. You know, it's a toaster. Nobody's going to pay $250,000 for a toaster.
It's kind of like a Rolex or a Swiss watch versus a digital watch, right?
That's a really apt example.
Why did Rolex not just switch over to cheap digital watches? You know, they could still done outside building.
The $10 watch that you buy at the dollar store probably is more accurate than the Rolex because, you know, the Rolex has mechanical movement in it rather than just a purely digital timepiece. But my God, you look at that magnificent jeweled timepiece, and that's what you're paying for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the intricacy, the ornateness of it, the craftsmanship of it. So, you know, these people don't get that. They don't understand. And why they're working in car journalism is absolutely beyond me. You know, when I was coming up, there was still the old guard present when I first started working in this business. And the old guard, they were car guys.
Yeah.
You know, and you could not get your foot in the door unless you were simpatico. You were like them. You mm-hmm. were interested in cars. You knew something about them. You know, you worked on them. Maybe you raced them in the weekends, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want people who didn't like cars being in their business. You know, now it's the opposite.
Was it David Davis or something? The guy at he was like Cogito Ergo Zoom, but he was the one that organized Cannonball Run, kind of in a protest to the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine. You know, Brock Yates was another one of the instigators behind that. Great guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but today, you know, somebody like that would be viewed as some sort of horrible patriarchal heterosexual. You know, a rolling coal maniac who can't be discussed in polite society.
That's absolutely true. Well, you know, when we look at where this is all headed, it really is going down the drain. Everything seems to be circling the drain. Talk about the difference between us and them. That's the headline of one of your articles.
You know, I was inspired to write that the other day because I got to thinking about COVID again and, mm-hmm. and the times in which we're living. And one of the things that has always kind of angered and frustrated me about COVID is that all the people who are the most hysterical enforcers of things like mask guidelines and who believed everybody should be forced to get the vaccine, generally speaking, they don't apologize. They don't concede they were wrong about that.
That's right.
And I think that's appalling. I think that as a human being, when you make a mistake, the only way you can recover your self-respect and your humanity is to admit, especially to those that you hurt, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done that.
Unless you're like Donald Trump, and then you don't make mistakes, right?
Well, so I'm admitting that I made a mistake in letting my hope cloud my judgment and having voted for Trump. I'm sorry for it. I shouldn't have done it. Not saying that I would have voted for Kamala Harris. I'm not voting anymore for any of them.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, I made a mistake. I thought maybe he's not the same guy that he was last time, but he was
mm-hmm.
worse than mm-hmm. I even imagined.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry for it. You know, and I think that, again, it's not about, it transcends politics, ideology, religion. If you make a mistake, if you do something wrong, you got fooled. That's not, you know, that's not a moral failing if you got fooled.
Mm-hmm.
We all make mistakes. You know, we sometimes, you know, just get rolled. Admit it, though, particularly mm-hmm. when harm was caused as a result of it and you were involved in it, even if not overtly because you just thought you were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish the people on our side, particularly people on our side, would not be like the COVIDians and, you know, would just say, you know, yeah, this is bad news. We have to stop this somehow. I'm not going to be part of this business any longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's always been with Trump, the debate's always been whether he's a fool or a tool of somebody or something else. And as we were talking before the interview, we were talking off air before the interview started, and I said, yeah. Question is he a psychopath or is he dementia? You know, we're talking about what he did over the weekend. And you came up with a third possibility. Tell the audience.
A tertiary syphilis, which is quite possible.
That's right. Absolutely. That would be an interesting revenge, wouldn't it, from the victim?
I wouldn't be the least surprised. You know, and again, this is a general thing, too. Another ironical juxtaposition is that the people who support Trump now were very critical of Joe Biden a few years ago because he was obviously an elderly man who was at the point where his faculties were obviously deteriorating physically as well as mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a big brouhaha about a guy that old shouldn't be in that position. Well, here we are with a guy who's older.
That's right.
You know, yeah. And he's going to be, you know, it's going to get progressively worse. You know, we still got almost 3 years to go. He'll be pushing 83 years old by the end of this.
That's
and
right.
I'm not, you know, like trying to make a big deal about people's age. I'm pointing out that there are jobs where, you know, maybe age is a factor. I think commercial airline pilots have to retire at 60, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good reason for that. Even if you're in excellent shape today as a 60-year-old, it's statistically not improbable that you might have a stroke or a heart attack tomorrow. And you don't want that guy in the left seat of your plane,
That's
you know,
right.
if you can avoid it, you put a younger person in that role. And I think that, you know, one of the lessons that we're all going to learn from this is that maybe there should be an upper age limit on people who are permitted to run for president.
Well, I think it's even more individualized than that. You know, when you look at the situation of his demonstrated condition that he showed everybody, frankly, I don't care. You know, it's like having somebody who is a mass murderer. Maybe he says that the dogs were telling him to kill all these people like Son of Sam. Or maybe he's just been a lifelong psychopath. Or maybe something else happened to him. I don't really care about his motivations as much as we need to do something about it, right? You got to get this guy off the street one way or the other. Life in prison or the electric chair, whichever you thought. Well, if that's the case with...
And who's going to do it?
Yeah, that's the case with Trump. I mean, you know, the issue is, we talk about, is it just because he's a vicious mad dog, or is it because he's becoming senile? I don't really care. The bottom line is we've seen what he's doing, and we know what he's doing to the entire world. And so the question is, how do we get this guy out of there? It's not what's wrong with him. We know what's wrong with him. What caused what's wrong with him is the only thing to be talked about. And I don't really care what the motivating factors were underneath that made him into what he is, what everybody can see he actually is right now.
So we'll see whether self-interest on the part of people within the Republican Party is operative. Mm-hmm. You know, I was heartened by what Joe Kent did, because, you know, he was a guy who's pretty unimpeachable in terms of his background, particularly on the topic at hand, the war.
That's right.
And very, very difficult for Trump, Captain Bone Spurs, to criticize this guy, you know, with multiple combat tours, how many Bronze Stars does he has, and all that. And he was immediately under Tulsi Gabbard, and so was in a position to know whether the Iranians were a threat to the United States. And clearly they weren't, according to him. So who are you going to believe? Mm-hmm. I hope that his example is followed and emulated.
Yeah.
And more people of good conscience come forward and say, I just can't be party to this any longer. And perhaps a crescendo will build, and perhaps a point will come, kind of like it did with Nixon in 74, where he's got to go.
Yeah.
You know, and he'll take that walk of shame to the helicopter and go back to Mar-a-Lago.
I just, you know, there's something about Trump and the leverage that he's got over everybody, which is really crazy. And I got to say, you know, if the Republican Party needs to be taught a lesson, and unfortunately, there's not any good way to do that. You know, if you vote against them, you're voting for a Democrat for the most part, and they've got their own issues that are different. But if I was still voting, I've given up on that. If I was still voting, I'd be hard pressed to know what to do. I look at it and I think, you know, if I was still going to vote, I would probably vote for a Democrat this time, because just to teach the Republicans a lesson. But I know what I'd get on the back end of that. And for the longest time, running as a third party candidate, would tell people, you know, that the lesser of two evils is still evil. I just don't want to vote for an evil. You know, they're evil in different ways. But somehow Trump has got to get taken out, and the Republican Party needs to be have a spine grafted into it for some reason. They need to see that there's a price to be paid for this. And I think that the Republican Party is going to pay a price for this. I think Trump is worse for the Republican Party than Jimmy Carter was for the Democrat Party. That's my take on it. What do you think?
Oh, I'll second and amen and third that. You know, Jimmy Carter, for all of his flaws, I don't think people perceived him as a loathsome person.
That's right.
You know, as a vile individual. They regarded him, as I remember, as just kind of inept, that he meant to do well, but, you know, he wasn't particularly competent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Trump, he is personally despised with reason, mm-hmm. By a large number of people who regard him as a despicable human being.
That's right.
You know, a person without compassion, without empathy, without decency.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that that's going to come back to bite him in his more than ample rear.
It is more than ample, isn't it? That's great. Well, on that note, we're running out of time, and we've gone a little bit over time, but thank you so much, Eric Peters, for joining us. And again, you can find him at ericpetersautos.com. There's a lot that is there that is food for thought, and it's always an interesting read. And we didn't have time to get to your build out for your Trans Am and your... I loved the way that you referred to it. It's alive. And you said, bringing back something that has been dead like this for a while, it really does feel kind of like Dr. Frankenstein bringing it back alive. And I bet it roared.
We'll have to talk about that the next time.
Yeah, I bet it roared when it came back to life. It must have been a lot of a lot of fun. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Again, ericpetersautos.com. Thank you, Eric. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Making sense common again. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
If you like the Eagles,
on a dark desert highway,
the Cars, and Huey Lewis in the News,
they say the hotter rock and roll is competing.
You'll love the Classic Hits channel at APS Radio. Download our app or listen now at APSradio.com.
Joining us now is someone who has spent their life during reconnaissance and surveillance. He's now into drones. And I think you're going to find this very interesting. We're going to talk about what happened to the great drone mystery back in the, I guess it's about a year and a half ago, back on the East Coast, as well as what has recently happened with some drones seen over the military bases where War Pete and Rubio live, and the threat really that it presents to all of us and how it is completely upending really the military order, I think. So joining us now is John Ferguson. And he's got a couple of different places where you can find him. He's got Saxon Unmanned is his company, and they have saxonunmanned.com. He also has a website about his personal story, johnbferguson.com, which is very fascinating. We'll try to talk a little bit about that as well. And he's also got another business, javajohns.net, just in case you're looking for some coffee. But thank you for joining us, John.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's begin with the great drone mystery. There was a lot of people trying to tie this into UFOs and stuff. And it's like, well, they've got lights on them, you know, let you know which direction they're going. So that might be a tip off. This is not something from another galaxy. But tell us, you know, when you looked at this investigation, what was your take on all this stuff?
Well, you know, again, thank you for having me on. You know, the whole drone thing back in 2024 and 25. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a real common sense kind of a guy, and I just got really tired of hearing the people that we elected to run this country and run our states were out there saying that they're coming out of the water and they're Iranian flagships and all this stuff. And
it's we had sheriffs who said, I can't catch them. It's like it's supernatural or something.
I just thought, oh my gosh, this country is in so much trouble if these are the people that are running the country. So, I just wanted to give a common sense approach, you know, and really just show America what, as a manufacturer, a subject matter expert. And again, I've been in unmanned system technology for over three decades, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm one of the few people in the United States that has not only subsurface, subsea, but ocean surface and tactical robot crawlers and unmanned aerial aircraft experience, right? So I'm really kind of a different person than most. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to give a common sense approach. The thing is that myself and two other gentlemen have been working for quite some time on trying to uncover the fact that some of the old Soviet era nuclear warheads had come up missing. There were 132 of them that came up missing and they were put into the black market. And the gentleman that I was working with had accidentally been exposed to one of these warheads and became very sick. And so from that point forward, he was tracking these things to try to find out where they were. And so that's when they brought me in. And the information that we had is that they were here and that they were planning on using it as a false flag operation. And so when all of these elected officials were out there saying that they're aliens or little green men or whatever, and you know, all this other stuff. I just felt compelled to just say, look, folks, I couldn't say at the time what exactly it was. I just said, look, I do believe that they're not looking for anything nefarious. Don't try to shoot them down. Or I'm sorry. I don't think they're nefarious drones. I don't think they're an adversarial nation's drones. I think they're looking for something very specific. And I believe that they're looking for the radioactive warhead that we have been working on. We knew it was. You know, so I had some cease and desist letters from the Biden administration. And of course I didn't cease and I didn't desist, but we, you know, we kept going with our investigation and we proved that, yeah, this is what they're looking for. Wow. Right. And, you know, they're flying, they're respecting somewhat of our FAA guidelines on unmanned system flight operations. They had lights on, you know, they're trying to to somewhat fly within our rules, right? So I knew that they weren't an adversarial nations. And then what administration would allow huge, large aircraft like that fly over our critical infrastructure without permission? Like this aircraft behind me, it's 14-foot wing aircraft, 150, 200 grand at its base model. You know, could you imagine an adversarial nation flying dozens and dozens of these over our critical infrastructure and our country just going, I don't know. So, you know, it didn't make sense to me. So that's why I did that video. And then still to this day, a lot of people had asked me, whatever happened, did they find the nuke? And I was like, well, I don't know. And so we had also recently uncovered that that is still out there and it is still in the hands of the bad guys. And they are planning on using that thing September, October of this year. Hmm. So we met with the authorities to try to bring this to light and get these folks to investigate this. And every time we brought it to the authorities, we've been shut down. Wow. So it's all been dismissed. So we turned over all of the black and white, the emails, the photos, the videos. There was a Pentagon report that stated that they had thought in the 90s that one of these assets was brought over. So what we did is we proved to where it was processed, who owned it, who sold it, who they sold it to, how they packed it, how they shipped it, how they brought it over here, who received it over here in the United States. And then we lost track of it from there. So, wow. You know, these are facts. It's not conspiracy or anything. And that's where we're at.
So who is this? Who are the bad actors that, can you say who they are?
You know, all of the bad guys that people speculate here in the United States are real. You know, please, I don't want to seem like I'm a politician and dodging a question, but for my own safety, I think I should just leave it at that. But all of the bad actors that you know exist, you're right. They're there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of the things that really concerns me. When you look at Iran, for example, and the drones that they have, who knows how many drones they've got? They were selling drones to Russia during the Ukraine war. So they were making more than they thought they actually needed. So I imagine they've got quite a few of them that are there. And it really has changed the face of warfare, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And, you know, that Shahid drone is, it's an adequate drone. And I try to impress upon people that a drone doesn't have to be this highly technologically advanced piece of equipment, right? I mean, my gosh, they're building drones out of cardboard. And they're working, right? You know, they're building them out of balsa wood, which they've been doing for decades, right? So the only thing a drone has to do is do its job. I know it sounds very basic, but it just has to fly. You know, there's a $500 module in that aircraft, any aircraft, really, a commercial aircraft, that tells the drone exactly what to do, when to do it, how much power to put out to wherever. And you can fly them completely 100% autonomously. You can plug in the coordinates and tell it what to do and just let her rip, and you can pack up and go home. And and it'll just go out there and just do the job. So it doesn't have to be technologically advanced. Again, it just has to carry a payload and do its job, and that's it.
Yeah, it's really been an equalizer, hasn't it? It's like the improvised roadside bombs that we saw in Iraq, except this is a lot more flexible, a lot more reach that we've seen. Now, the drones that you sell at Saxon, tell us a little bit about your product line. You know, you mentioned the large one behind you. What type of drones do you sell? How big are they? What are they capable of doing? They carry a payload of, how much and so forth?
Yeah. You know, the drones that we build, you know, I've developed a couple of different technologies that try to help save lives. I've built subsea power pack systems, tactical crawlers, and my drones are kind of unique in the industry. And the reason why is because I've managed projects overseas for submersible vehicles that have a cost of $1.2 to $1.5 million a day cost. Wow. And so, you know, I've seen 50-cent parts drop a project for 2 weeks. So there's 1,440 minutes in the day. And when you have a project that's at $1.5 million in value or in cost per day, you know, every minute has a huge dollar sign attached to it. So I developed my aircraft to be, you know, modular, robust, you know, very rugged, very dependable, and it's designed to save lives or to, you know, provide intelligence that, you know, our warfighters wouldn't normally get in the battlefield with a high level of dependability, right? So,
and of course, you did that when you were in the Marines. You were doing recon, and you were doing it in the water yourself, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I want to make sure that I don't oversell what I did in the Marine Corps because of stolen valor and all that other stuff. But I, you know, I was a reconnaissance scout swimmer. You know, I wasn't like a Navy SEAL or a force recon guy. You know, I was low level reconnaissance scout swimmer guy. So they would drop us off in the water, and we would swim in and attack the beach or the pier, do the reconnaissance, and then set in lanes for the boat company, the Raiders, to come in and attack the objective. So yeah, I've done a lot of reconnaissance type missions, and that's really how I developed my companies, because I wanted to kind of be back in the Marine Corps and not have to follow orders.
Yeah. There was a guy that I worked with at Texas Instruments that was a little bit older than I was. And I told you this as we were talking off air before the interview began. They would do that to him in Vietnam. They would take him and way out in, you know, behind enemy lines and drop them in the jungle, and they'd have to find their way out. Took them several days, and they're, you know, trying to move at night and sleep during the day, and he'd wake up and there's spiders all over him and a enemy patrol just a few feet away. And he said it was a really harrowing experience. And, you know, they would just work their way back and write about what they saw. And he said what was really strange about that was then after you did that, they would fly you to Hawaii for a couple of week vacation. Then it was back into the jungle again. It's just like whips on them back and forth, these different experiences. Yeah, so you were doing stuff kind of like that, I guess, except in the water. And then now, as you pointed out, with the drones, they can do that kind of surveillance without endangering people's lives. So that's an important thing. But talk a little bit about what you know in terms of the drones that we see that are happening in this Mideast war right now that's going on that with Iran, and how that has changed the battlefield and the threats that presents to critical infrastructure here in the United States. If probably not something that's difficult for somebody to get across the border with, and it's also we have to be concerned about cartels as well as hostile nations attacking our infrastructure, don't we?
Yeah, and it's very serious. You brought up a really good point. You know, again, from the beginning of warfare, we've always sent out reconnaissance teams to collect data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those folks have always given their lives to try to collect that data. And, you know, you don't need a big drone like this to go collect information on an objective anymore, right? A $2,000 or $3,000 drone that you buy at Best Buy or Amazon will do all of that for you. So, you know, these drones will fly over and they'll take pictures of critical infrastructure or the potential battlefield, and all of those images have geotagged images on them. So you can take all of those images and put them all together in this software, and you can create a map. And this map could be accurate down to less than an inch, right? Wow. So every military map you'll ever see or pilot's map will always have, you know, for the most part, they'll always have elevations on them. And that's very important for covering concealment, you know, depressions, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so these drones can fly over a target and you can get the digital elevation model that tells you the elevations, right? Mm-hmm. You can get the altitudes or the height of buildings or, you know, vehicles, and you can build a 3D map off of these. And so anytime you're going to go and attack an objective, that you will need to have that data, because maybe you want to blow up a building, but you don't know how big of a missile you need to use or whatever, but that information will tell you, mm-hmm. okay? That's mm-hmm. more information that you'll collect in minutes over what any human being can collect in the same amount of time. So that's very important, especially allowing drones to fly over here domestically over our critical infrastructure. Now, the Ukraine and the Russians have done an amazing job. Not that I agree with that whole war, but the Ukrainians and the Russians have done a fantastic job of revolutionizing the battlefield, because you can take a less than $1,000 drone and strap a grenade to it or some form of an explosive, mm-hmm. and you can set it out on its mission, And that can absolutely devastate the battlefield. And so, you know, the Iranian drones, I mean, these things are, they're just adequate drones, and they're highly capable, and they're terrifying. And that's what they're used for. Mm-hmm. Now, the cartels, the Marine Corps had published a few years ago during the Biden administration that the cartels were sending 100 drones an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with fentanyl, you know, coming into the United States.
Wow.
And I spent several years working on the border to combat narco-terrorism, human trafficking, and child sex trafficking. You know, I just volunteered a lot of my time to do that. But I also worked south of the border doing the exact same thing. And so I got a different perspective on the stuff coming into the United States than most people do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with, you know, all of this fentanyl and all these nasty drugs and weapons that the cartels bringing in, you know, they can just do it with drones. And the problem is that our counter drone defense is great. There's a lot of great companies out there building it, but it needs to get better, and it needs to get better fast, because, you know, a lot of these things can slip through the wire, but mostly it's pretty good. But, you know, we get those incursions.
And again, you know, if we're going to be starting wars everywhere with everybody, it's going to be not just drugs coming across, but it's going to be things like bombs and that type of thing that's coming across as well. So the drones that you have, like the large one behind you, what would that be used for?
This is a great platform because it carries 15 to 20 pounds. And, you know, that 15 to 20 pounds can be a sensor or it could be some form of a munition. Of course, we don't do that. Got to clarify that. But, you know, it flies for 18 plus hours. Not that you would fly a drone for that long, but it's, again, it's very highly reliable. But a drone is really just a platform to give a sensor a ride and give it a good ride, a smooth ride, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, you can put, we can use this for agriculture. We can use it for construction, asset management. You can use it for search and rescue. It's largely built for ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. So you can put that little ball turret gimbal where, there you go. That gimbal in there, you can zoom 30 times, zoom power down to a location. So you can really get a good sense of what's down there. And if there's, you know, targets of interest or whatever, you can loiter over a battlefield as a loitering munition. So you can stay aloft for many hours and wait for the bad guys to come through, you know, or, you know, find people lost in the mountains, you know. So there's nothing you can't do with these things. The only things that limit you on drones is your imagination.
Wow. Well, in our area, we've got our own personal drone, but I can't fly it because we've got so many hawks around here. I mean, I look at these people saying, how are we going to defend against stuff? It's like, well, if it's really small drones, you just get a bunch of predatory birds that don't want, you know, but they wouldn't do too well against the one that's behind you. But
birds are very intelligent. Yeah. I've done work with birds and drones, and their birds are so intelligent. You would never realize how intelligent they actually are.
You know, there was an interesting novel a few years ago by Daniel Suarez. It's called Kill Decision. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but he was really ahead of his time. It's about a decade ago. And in it, he was talking about drones and the use of warfare. And it was very interesting the way he constructed it, because he had a confluence of some military industrial types along with some people who were entomologists, insects, right? And so they came up with a kind of a way to signal with each other, like, you know, mimicking insects that was that allowed them to do swarms of drones. Where are we in terms of that? Do you think... in terms of drone swarms, that's the thing that is really concerning. And of course, you know, when we look at warfare, that is a real issue. What about drones, drone swarms, and being able to lock onto a target and kind of have some communication between them as, in terms of artificial intelligence and that type of thing?
Yeah, that's, again, that's a great question. You know, this aircraft behind me here, it can swarm. You know, that's just software, right? So, you know, the autopilots will actually, I mean, again, the $500 autopilot will allow you to swarm this type of an aircraft. It's $500, right? So it's very insignificant. A lot of people say that the Shahid drone is a $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000 drone, but I guarantee I could make that drone for less than $20,000, right? Mm-hmm. But that drone can swarm. Swarm technology is wonderful, and you get to see all kinds of pretty stuff on, you know, Super Bowl halftime shows and all that stuff. it's wonderful. There is some technology issues that we have with swarming drones. And when you have the larger drones that swarm, yeah, that's a problem. But is it likely that we're here domestically in the United States going to get hit with big drones like this in a swarm? Not really. Mm-hmm. It's highly unlikely. But a lot of people have seen the videos where you got little bitty small drones that can acquire a target and have an explosive and, you know, take personnel out, right? Mm-hmm. And using AI, it can choose who to take out. There are certain laws of physics that you can't overcome, and that you can't, you know, your battery life, your power consumption and the power discharge from the battery to keep the thing in the air is really limiting on your amount of flight time. So those little bitty drones, they only will get maybe 3 to 5 minutes of flight time. So mm-hmm. you can't launch it, find a target, acquire the target, then prosecute the target in 3 to 5 minutes. It's just not going to work. So I don't think people need to be too concerned about that at this time. The battery technology is not out there yet, mm-hmm. but that's not saying that we should not be concerned about adversarial nations getting a hold of small drones and utilizing them here in the United States.
And of course, that video that was done, it was part of a TED Talk thing, I think somebody did, where
yes.
they were talking about those assassination drones, determining which ones, yeah. which people are going to target, you know, and using that against politicians in Congress or something like that. But that's something that is down the road. It's just incremental increases in technology, I guess. But the other aspect of it, you know, we've had a couple of things that have come out in the news recently that had some domestic connections. One of them was the fact there's drones flying over the House of let's see if I got the clip here. Which one of those is it, Lance? Over the military bases here. You got War Pete and Rubio pointing to the drones because they're flying over the military bases where these guys are living, because we had a lot of Trump administration people have now moved on to military bases. And so they had these drones that were spotted over that military base. Talk a little bit about that. What was behind that?
Well, you know, a lot of people around the United States are getting wrapped around the axles on this thing. And of course, it's very ominous to think that an adversarial nation can fly drones over our most critical infrastructure and mm-hmm. our, you know, executive leadership in our country, right? Mm-hmm. This happens all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not new to have people who are ill-equipped and ill-informed to fly their aircraft over these bases when they're not allowed to. You know, the Chinese have, of course, the administration is working on getting the Chinese spy drones out of here. Mm-hmm. But they have a software packet that's integrated into the system where it won't allow you to fly into a no-fly zone. And those are clearly marked on the maps when you plan your route. Mm-hmm. You can bypass that. But you are electing to bypass that. And if you break the law, then, you know, that's on you. Mm-hmm. And we also have what we call remote ID, which is a little module that is in every aircraft sold here in the United States that shows law enforcement of, you know, who owns the aircraft. And then I believe it shows the location of the pilot's ground station. I'm not sure if that's correct, but you know, these people can fly drones over military bases. And I think it's just people doing stupid stuff. Mm. Again, I'll go back to one of my original statements. Do you honestly think that this administration or any other administration would allow this large of a drone to fly over the base mm-hmm. without permission?
Yeah, because just had that situation down in Mar-a-Lago. You had somebody who sounded like they were kind of out of it. It's no yeah. fly area there. And they sent up jets to intercept him. And they said, yeah, this guy, we kind of wake him up, you know, basically he's not paying attention. But what was really alarming to me was I saw these comments like, just blow him out of the sky. You know, this guy doesn't deserve to live. And it's like, whoa, let's back up a little bit here. But But yeah, they're very quick to scramble the jets for things like that. And of course, even if it's flying over the homes of politicians, high level politicians like that, those are going to be pretty hardened targets. What's not hardened, I think, are the utility power plants or things like oil refineries here in this country. There's so many issues with that. They immediately started talking about, we got to worry about our AI data centers. So we're going to have some automatic guns that are maybe driven by AI that are going to shoot these things down. It's like, well, yeah, they don't ever talk about it for us, though. You know, they're worried about our high-ranking officials. They're worried about the artificial intelligence that's going to be used to spy and surveil us. But they're not really worried about whether or not we can turn the lights on. That seems to be the common thread with all this stuff.
Well, I would challenge you to go back in our 250-year history and find any administration that gives a damn about the American people, right?
That's right.
But you know, you can shoot these drones down. But the problem is that we trip over our own bureaucracy here in the United States where other countries don't. Mm-hmm. You know, you can disrupt the frequency with these drones. And mm-hmm. they have frequency hopping. So typically we use 2.4 or 5.8 or 900, you know, frequency here mm-hmm. to fly our aircraft. That's pretty common, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other bands. But, you know, when you hit a drone with some sort of frequency disruptor, you know, they can frequency hop and they can mm-hmm. switch to a different freq and continue on. So those are difficult. You can shoot them with lasers. You can shoot them with microwave pulses. Or you can just shoot them with bullets. The problem is, okay, if you've identified the drone and you're going to make that decision to take that drone down, but what about the family of four that's in the Cessna that's 10,000 feet? You know, just because you mm-hmm. shoot some form of a energy weapon or whatever, frequency disruption weapon, you know, at the drone, it doesn't stop at the drone, mm-hmm. right? So they don't want to drop a manned aircraft over, you know, because of a drone, right?
Right.
So what I propose is things that we do on accident, we should be able to do on purpose. And that's crash one drone into another, right?
Oh, so, yeah.
You know, if you can take an unmanned aircraft, like our smaller ones, and you can fly that into a drone that needs to be taken down, you have more control. Mm-hmm. And there's software that will, you know, select that target, and then you can automatically engage that target using another aircraft. That way, it's just going to have a less of a probability of having, you know, adverse effects on the civilians, you know, in the area. And that's what I propose. But we have to really shore up our defensive posture here in America regarding unmanned systems.
Well, you know, that's something that we've had this debate for a long time. It began a long time ago with EMP, you know, electromagnetic pulse. You know, what if somebody flies a nuke and explodes it in the atmosphere, takes out all kinds of electronics and maybe takes out some of these big, unique transformers that have a very long lead time to get them replaced and only made in a couple of places in the world, you know, incredibly expensive, difficult to replace. And so there's some very simple things that could be done to protect against EMP, but they don't do that. So I imagine they're not going to do much to protect the infrastructure against drone attacks either. And there's so many critical places of critical infrastructure, as we're seeing with this situation with Iran. You know, you've got a refinery. It's very you don't need much of an explosive to get that thing going. And when you look at these vulnerable infrastructures, like, you know, power generation, power transformers that are that can be taken out and cause massive cascading effects, and nobody's really doing anything about that, are they?
Yeah, well, you know, all of the reconnaissance on America is pretty much done, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, the company DJI, they build an amazing aircraft. I mean, everybody loves the aircraft. They're easy, they're mm-hmm. dependable. You know, they're just good aircraft. But the problem is that they got caught spying on. Well, through their drones. So pretty much every country in the world has had those DJI drones flying everywhere. So all of that data, you know, has gone back to China, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why the Biden and Trump administration was working on getting them kicked out of the United States. And, mm-hmm. you know, critical infrastructure now, you cannot use those types of, you know, Chinese drones because, well, they were caught collecting our data. So all of our power lines and refineries and, you know, sewer plants and construction sites and hospitals and every single thing you could ever possibly imagine has already been mapped, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's no requirement anymore really to select targets to map because they've mostly all been mapped, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing that the government can do now about that other than just, you know, stop the spying. Mm-hmm. They just, there's nothing else you can do. It's all been mapped. So what these drones have done is they have really tested our weaknesses here in the United States. And the media has done a great job of telling everybody in the world, you know, what our weaknesses are. And that's mm-hmm. why I've said a couple of times on this show is that we've got to really beef up our defensive posture here in the United States regarding unmanned aircraft, because, you know, almost every nation in the world has suffered some form of an invasion at one point or another, right? Mm-hmm, throughout mm-hmm. history. You know, I think we're probably past due for another one. And right. and I think I don't want to strike fear into Americans, but I do want Americans to understand that this war that we're fighting, this environment that we're in, the technology that is being utilized, and couple that with AI, that I do believe that we are going to really get hit with drones, as some form of a drone attack, very soon. I don't know anything.
I agree. Yeah. And you know, when you look at it, you talk about how everything is already mapped out. A good example of that, I think, is the fact that we have these very sophisticated systems in the Gulf states that were there. And some of the very first ones that got taken out, there was, I believe it was a $1 billion radar facility that was kind of the nerve center, the eyes and ears of these anti-ballistic missile systems. And that was one of the first things that they targeted. They knew that. We operate in an environment now, as you point out, everybody knows everything about everybody. All the stuff is exposed. And they know where yeah. the targets are, and it's not that difficult. As you were pointing out, you can get some very inexpensive devices to drive the drone, and you've already got it mapped out as to where it is. And that's what they did at the opening rounds of the retaliation strikes from Iran. They went right after a lot of very high value targets and radar targets and things like that. And so that's something yeah. that's very different. And as you point out, you know, we in America, we've gone through a couple of world wars without anything happening on our soil. So we think, well, we don't have anything to worry about. But now there's this asymmetry to the warfare that I think is really going to bite us, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some information that was just quietly released about Iran taking delivery of over 500. What do they call that? Oh, my gosh. Starts with an S. So, Cision missile or whatever. Hmm. They just took over
from China.
From North Korea.
Of North Korea.
And these are hypersonic type missiles that you can't really shoot down. Mm-hmm. And they have taken over 500 of these. Wow. Right? They've taken delivery of all of these, and they can reach, you know, here in the United States and most definitely Israel, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, this whole conflict with Iran, you know, I hope and pray that this will be, you know, this will be ending very, very, very soon. But we do have a very high probability of this thing, you know, escalating out of our control.
Looks like it's already doing that in terms of reports of Karg Island getting hit.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I really just absolutely despise is, you know, on the mainstream media, and a lot of shows, you know, you have these old generals and old retired senators and, you know, people of authority who are very respectable people, but they're going out on the news and they're saying, well, the Trump administration is going to do this and this is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. I was never a high level, you know, person in the military. I mean, I I was mischievous and I always got in trouble. So, you know, I bounced off the rank structure like a yo-yo. So, but I was a good Marine, right? But again, I just close my ears when I hear all this stuff because nobody knows the decisions that are being made inside the administration, right? I get that it's a lot of fun to talk about it and speculate, but for these people that go up and just say, well, we're going to do this and this and this, you know, I can't listen to it because nobody really knows. But if we're speculating, you know, this truly does with all of the things that are happening. And there's a lot of things that we don't know that's happening behind closed doors, especially in Iran, that I do speculate that this could get very messy. Unless I'm hoping, what is it, tonight at 8 o'clock?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're recording this on Tuesday. And so, Tuesday night. But of course, earlier this morning, they already attacked Karg Island. So, I mean, he's kicking stuff off and escalating.
I'm anticipating that they're not going to have an agreement by 8 o'clock tonight.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I'm concerned about. And again, the other thing that is concerning is that as you watch government officials, and I know maybe part of it is they're trying to project confidence or whatever, but what comes across is kind of a detached hubris that thinks that we can't be touched. And that really is disturbing because that is an invitation for disaster, I think, whether we're talking about, you know, civil defense. And of course, you point out the American government doesn't do anything about civil defense. So it's a great book about that a few years ago. Called Raven Rock, The Plan to Save Themselves and Let the Rest of Us Die. And it's not about how there was no civil defense plan ever really during the Cold War for people. And of course, I don't really think there is now at this point either. You see other countries like Germany as they're trying to escalate the war. And it seems to me like Germany and France and these different European countries want to escalate the war. And so, but they are at least doing civil defense drills and drills about how to do mass evacuations and things like that. Not in the American government. They're not going to do anything like that.
Well, you know, we discussed at the beginning of this show that there are at least one, maybe two nuclear warheads here in the United States. Fact. So we also have enough fentanyl or carfentanil in the United States to kill every man, woman, and child on the planet 10 times over. And you've got to let that sink in, right? And I always said that it was just in the United States. There's enough fentanyl in the United States to kill every man, woman, and child in the United States 10 times over. Well, the news, the mainstream media had done like a really quick blurb on that and said it's enough in the whole world, right? So, you know, we also let over 30 million people into this country in the Biden administration. And you know, there were some that were bad, right? So to say that we can't be touched is not something that I would get on board with, because everything that we need to be touched is already here. And, you know, we found during the border work that I've done, we found that China was bringing shipping containers in through the cartels with, you know, millions of rounds of ammunition and small arms. And the Iranian truck drivers were distributing those containers all around the United States. So, you know, again, fact, not conspiracy or speculation or anything. Like I did the work, right? So everything that they need to do some form of nefarious assault on this country is already here. So are they going to, you know, pull up a container ship and launch a bunch of drones out of a container ship? You know, 100% intent, 0% probability, you know, because we have those big gray things off the coast, the Navy that won't let that happen. Right. So,
Well, it just so many different, I mean, we saw in some attacks, I forget whether it was Ukrainian, I think it's Ukrainians doing it to the Russians when they destroyed so many of those very high value planes on the ground. The way they did that was they had some semi-trailers that had like a false ceiling in it, right? And they opened that up and these things, you know, they park them not too far away from the airport and then fly all those drones in that were hidden and concealed in the 18-wheelers. So, I wonder, there's a lot of different ways that you can do things like that, right?
You think the Ukrainians did that by themselves?
Yeah, that's right. They're really resourceful, aren't they?
I'm curious.
Yeah.
There's a lot to read between the lines there.
Yeah, yeah, there isn't there. Well, again, things have changed so much, and we don't really really understand it. And I thought it was interesting when you're talking about how a little tiny part can completely scuttle the whole mission if it's substandard. We certainly have seen that with the aircraft carrier, haven't we? The Gerald Ford class, they had the toilet issue.
Yeah.
So I guess they had not an Achilles heel, but they had an Achilles something or the other, right, that caused a problem with that. And now we got the same situation with the spacecraft, the Artemis. They were saying their toilets aren't working. So we are looking at an SHTF kind of scenario with so many different areas. And it seems to be always the really complicated, sophisticated systems that they build that seem to be taken down by the very, very simple bug that's in it somewhere, right?
Yeah, you know, I was managing a project over in West Africa, and our cost, I think our cost was like $1.2 million a day. And there's these little fuses called Pico fuses. Mm-hmm. We had some Pico fuses go out in one of our subs, and that dropped the whole entire project for about 2 weeks. So if you can imagine... 50 cent part dropping a $1.2 million project. And boy, I tell you what, some heads rolled over that one.
I bet. Yeah. Well, it certainly is interesting talking to you. Tell us a little bit about your personal story. You've got a website, johnbferguson.com. What's that about?
Yeah, that should be going live, I hope, here in the next couple of hours. But, you know, I have somewhat of an interesting story. You know, I came from Kansas, and I had a lot of let me get out of here. So sorry about that.
That's all right. So kind of like Dorothy, you got swept up in the air with the not a tornado but a drone, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, coming from a small town in Kansas, I'd lived under a stepfather that was very abusive, and actually he had tortured me. Mm. And I suffered through many years of that. And it's interesting, but I have this story about all of this abuse, you know, growing up and, you know, my father rescuing me and that had affected me considerably. And still, you know, even still to this day, you know, you suffer those effects. Right. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that, you know,
How old were you when that was happening?
Third grade, third grade when the divorce happened. Mm-hmm. And in my fourth grade year, I was an angry child because I was retaliating against this divorce and a kid was picking on me. So I broke his nose. Mm. And so they took a box and they put it in the auditorium and they put the desk in the box. And for the whole entire year, I had to stay at that desk in that box in the auditorium and not, you know, communicate with other children. Wow. And they would funnel all of the children in during the lunch hour next to the box. And they would all ridicule me, you know, they did this for the entire year because, you know, when they were going to have lunch in the auditorium. Right. And mm-hmm. so I missed out on my fourth grade year and I always was, you know, left behind academically. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, coming home, you know, every night to being tortured by my stepfather was, it was a really ungodly, situation for me. And I can't believe I actually survived the whole thing. But then, you know, I was always kind of not really taken serious. And so when I got into my high school years, I had retaliated and I joined the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps whipped me into shape and taught me how to set goals. And so I came from, you know, this tortured young child and who shouldn't have ever survived all the way through high school and into the Marine Corps, and then became a deep sea diver and a piloting submersible vehicles. And now, you know, I get to meet with presidents and kings and queens and sovereign councils. And, you know, I've tried to achieve, and I try to do this and be very humble, you know, and not narcissistic, because those are big keywords for me.
Mm-hmm.
But now I've traveled to 87 countries around the world, and I've got to go meet some of the most amazing people in the world. And I've been asked to take my story and get in front of those who may need to hear the story of my survival, but not only my survival, but my abilities to achieve goals.
Yeah.
And really try to become somebody. And here in the state of Kansas, you know, God willing, I probably run for office here. Burundi and South Sudan have, you know, asked if I could be an ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to their countries, which certainly is a possibility. But I want to make sure that it's not about me, but it's about the survival, and it's about the willingness to really focus and try to achieve and try to get out of that nasty situation. So
yeah, that truly is amazing. That story about what happened to you in the fourth grade is amazing. My wife was a elementary school teacher, and they had a open classroom situation, so she could hear, couldn't avoid hearing what was going on in the next room. And there was a very abusive teacher in the adjacent room. And there was this little kid who she just picked on him, and it would make him stand in the trash can, said, "You're nothing but a piece of trash." What happened to you is way beyond that. I mean, she saw that, and she said, she went to the principal. She said, "You got to do something about this. You got to stop her." And he goes, "I know she's very abusive, but there's nothing we can do about it. She's got tenure." And so Karen got out of it. What's that?
Yeah. My stepdad, he would put aluminum foil over the vents in my room, which was the size of a closet.
Mm.
And during the summers, I couldn't get any air. And my sheets were sticking to my back because I'd sweat, and I'd stick my face out through the screen to try to get air. And I'd chew ice all night just to lower my core temperature down. And and the same during the winter, but I was always kicked out of the house during the day. So I was never allowed to come back in. They would lock the refrigerator, so I couldn't get food. Mm. You know, I mean, I was whipped with a graphite fishing rod.
Wow.
And the hook had hooked into my leg and ripped my leg out. And I mean, just all of this, just horrible stuff but I think it made me the person that I am today. And that's not necessarily like a good thing. Right. But it's given me the strength. With the Marine Corps, has given me the strength to fight through it and not become a serial killer. Or
well, the Marines ought to fund a biopic for you. You know,
I don't know. But the big thing is that you know, I never really ever thought that I would stand on a stage and talk to people about my story. But you know, I've been asked to do that by the Mexicans. You know, come up and talk about what they're fighting down south and the border. Mm-hmm. And you know, this story. And you know, I've been in a situation. I was smuggled into China because I was dying. I've flatlined. I've crossed over twice. And so I'm writing this book called Nine Lives and Counting, because of all of the different countries I've been to. I've been in situations where I've stood at the edge of death, and I've tripped over that line a couple of times. And just recently, I just came back from an African nation trying to help stop some genocide over in an African nation that I won't mention. And I got dysentery and almost didn't make it there either. So this was just a couple months ago.
Wow.
It's a hell of a diet program for me, though. I lost 30 pounds.
Yeah, I bet that's one way to do it, isn't it? But you said you flatlined a couple of times and crossed over. You have a near-death experience. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, a few times. Wow. Wow. And that's why the book is called Nine Lives and Counting, because I've been in those situations where I've crossed over into, you know, I've stepped over that line several times.
Wow.
And you know, I've left my body. I turned around, I looked, I saw my body laying there. And I just remember this as crystal clear as if it just happened 15 minutes ago. And, you know, I just said the Lord's Prayer, and I just said, "Lord, please, not here, not now." And, you know, I have a family. I can't leave. I can't leave. Not here. No, not in China, you know? I survived. And, a lot of people said, "Well, did you see the white light?" And I said, "No, but I smelled a lot of sulfur." That's a joke. That's a joke.
Okay.
But it was a very wonderful feeling to, you know, it's kind of like you had, it's kind of like you were laying there and somebody was stacking rocks on your chest and you were being crushed. And then all of a sudden somebody just started lifting those rocks off of you, you know, but I knew that, that God had, I knew he had other plans for me, you know, so.
Yeah, there's an interesting interesting book by a pastor in Austin, and he said he thinks this is something, you know, the medical equipment that we've got now, he said he thinks it is something that is really, he sees it as an evangelism opportunity, because he said, even though you got a lot of people interpret it differently, he said, if you look at what they're saying, there's some amazing experiences that some people have had, and some people who are different religion, they weren't projecting what they came across. They weren't projecting that from what they expected, for example. And he said, if you look at it, the common experiences that are there, he said they really line up with the Bible. And so he sees it as an evangelical tool, you know, to talk to people. Of course, you know, it's not sufficient, but it is interesting, and it is something that we're seeing happening more and more, I guess, because of the ability to revive people, the medical technology that we've got that we used to not have.
Yeah, you know, I never made it to the point to where I saw family members or I saw God or I saw Jesus or, you know, anything like that. You know, I, you know, what everything that I experienced was what I felt. And, you know, I felt a huge presence. You know, I knew, and it gives me shivers just talking about it now, but, you know, I know that that there's a God, you know, and I don't have to worry about that. I know what I know, and you know, people can listen to my story, and they can choose to believe me or not, and that's okay because I know in my heart, in my mind, that there is something so much larger out there, and it's peaceful. It's not anything other than just warmth, love, and peace. And that's all I know about it. And I know, and I have this feeling in my mind that I'm meant to do something, you know, here in this life. Maybe I've already done it. Maybe I haven't done it yet. Maybe I'm doing it now. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I ultimately decide to check out, I will know if I've accomplished, because I'm sure he'll let me know. I'm sure he'll let me know if I've accomplished the mission.
That's right. Well, it certainly is interesting to talk to you. And drones are one of those things that are really exploding in terms of their influence on our lives. And I hope it's going to be a positive one. Of course, you know, we already have a lot of the, one of the things that I find really fascinating, you see a lot of YouTube videos, of course, people flying over volcanoes or going really fast with the really super fast drones that they can fly through obstacles and stuff like that. So it can make some very interesting video that's there, but it is something that has completely changed the calculus for war and also for terrorism. And it's something we should really pay attention to. Thank you so much for joining us again, John Ferguson. Before we go, tell us briefly a little bit about the coffee, javajohns.net. Or Java, is it John or John's? I think it's John, right?
It's Java Johns with an S.
Okay. Yeah. Tell us a bit about that.
Piloting submersible vehicles, traveling around the world. 2002 was kind of a different time. somewhat different than it is now. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to just stop traveling as much and get home. So I started a coffee roastery. And my wife and I ran it, and it's still in operation today. So we roast fresh coffee daily. And wow. I actually consider myself one of the first Patriots coffee companies, because during the war, my platoon commander he was on his sixth tour in Iraq, and he had suffered a traumatic brain injury, and he started the Wounded Warriors Regiment, not the Wounded Warriors nonprofit, but the regiment. So he was helping injured men and women come home. So I wanted to do the same. So we decided to build a chopper, a motorcycle called the Chopper of Honor, in honor of all of those men and women who have, you know, been injured or killed in the war, and I would take their story and I would put their picture and their story on the coffee bag, and we would sell those coffee bags, and the proceeds would go to those families. So, and I still do that today, but yeah, we've been roasting coffee since 2002, and I'm starting to scale the company now. You know, along with Saxon, the drone company. But I think it's important that we just do our part. We try to create jobs, growth, and help those that need it.
Well, that's pretty good track record you got there. You've gone for 24 years, I guess. And so that's pretty good for a business. A lot of businesses don't make it that long. You know, the first 5 years is really critical. Tell me a little bit about, since you got a small business and you're doing coffee, and you got to import that, how are the tariffs affecting you? And, you know, and what do you think is, what are you looking for in your business in terms of, you know, we're going to see, I think, transportation costs explode here in the next few months. What are you thinking about as a small businessman when you look at all this economic chaos that's being unleashed on the world right now?
Oh my gosh. You know, I'm an optimistic individual, but I'm only optimistic until it affects my checkbook. But, you know, coffee prices have gone up, you know, considerably. Where I'm being affected more is we were manufacturing our drones in Poland, but then we fell out of love with those folks because they were selling our aircraft behind our backs, and you know, they were doing us pretty dirty. So then of course when President Trump got back in office. And as of course, we are really undergoing the Made in America initiative. We decided it was just a good time for us to repatriate our manufacturing back here to the United States. And that's what we're doing that right now. Mm-hmm. So everything's just gone up. The transportation prices are just unbearable. You know, the fuel price and everything.
Being able to get components? You know, and it turns even things like aluminum that's being affected by what's happening in the Gulf right now. Are you having any shortages yet?
Everything. Well, you know, again, it's the tariffs are a huge issue. But right now, you know, we're getting requests for drones, for very inexpensive drones. We're not getting a request for like 2 or 3 or 5 or 10. We're getting requests for 1,400, 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 drones at a whack, right?
What are people doing with that many drones?
Well, they're sending them to the battlefield.
So it's the government. It's the government that's doing that, right?
Yeah. Right. Or interceptor type drones, so that you know they can intercept drone on drone, which is literally what I was saying at the beginning of our interview here. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that we have this thing. It's NDA compliant. They have to be made in America, and that's okay. That's wonderful. But it is more expensive. The problem is that all of the lithium batteries that we use, all of the lithium cells they're manufactured in China, right? Yeah. All of the motors, the copper, the windings, the magnets, you know, those are all manufactured in China. So we're really being stifled by not only the disruption in the relationship between China and the United States right now, but also all of these conflicts that are happening around the world. There's this massive influx of requirements for drones, and these manufacturing companies that are manufacturing these components, they can't keep up. So it's a great industry to be in because you're busy. But it's not great when you can't fulfill the requirements that you have here in the United States, right?
That's right.
So it doesn't do any good to get an order for 5,000 drones and get them delivered in a month or two or three or six when you can't get them.
You know, and it doesn't do any good to have domestic drones if you don't have any source of domestic batteries to run them with. That was my whole issue with the tariff stuff. It's like, okay, well, your goal is this, but you don't even have a way to get there. You're just going to slam the door shut on what's coming in right now without having prepared to make sure that you got the raw materials, to make sure that you got the components that are not manufactured here. I mean, you can't do it all at once. I've said so many times we need to send a copy of Leonard Reed's Eye Pencil to the White House.
The Chinese, they subsidize their drone technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of really smart engineers just sitting around thinking up, you know, cool stuff to do, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's why they're leading in the drone industry on the commercial side, not so much the military side, the commercial side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all of the tariff stuff that Trump's doing and all of the investment that he's bringing back into the country and all of the DOGE stuff, and there's all this money that's, you know, supposed to be coming into the United States, you know, why don't we just shave off $2 or $3 billion of that and invest that into our drone manufacturing facilities that are manufacturing American-made drones here in America? You're creating jobs. You're creating growth. You're creating sustainability. You're making people happy, and you would be building one of the most incredible defensive technologies in the United States. So why don't we do that? I mean, that's what I would do, but I'm not in the White House.
Well, I'm not in the White House either. My approach would be just to get the government off of our back, and I think that we kind of figured out ourselves. That seemed to always be the advantage that Americans had over planned economies where the government's going to decide, because usually what happens with the government, we see it with our own, is a malinvestment. I mean, you can see malinvestment with China in terms of the housing market and the real estate market that they did there. My instinct is always go back to the free market. How about if we get freer rather than more subsidized? That's kind of my bias as I look at it.
I have been working in these Central African nations for many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. You know, I got sick and tired of dealing with United States bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. When the drone stuff came out, the FAA had a very challenging job, and that's how to integrate these into our airspace. And I knew that the FAA was going to have to stifle drone growth in America, right? Mm-hmm. So I went overseas, and we have this thing called BVLOS, Beyond Visual Line of Sight. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, I want to do BVLOS, you know? Well, I've been doing it years overseas because I wasn't going to be stifled by the FAA, right? Mm-hmm. And again, mm-hmm. nothing bad about the FAA. They have to do it right, or they're going to cause, you know, loss of life, right? Mm-hmm. So here in the United States, I go and work in these Central African nations to try to, you know, build relationships between these African nations and the United States and us, because I don't want to rely specifically on our economy. I want to merge two economies so we can all grow together. And mm-hmm. like we mm-hmm. get African water machines that make water out of humidity. So yeah. There's African villages out there that have never had a clean glass of drinking water their entire lives. So we bring these water machines over there and they get to have a clean glass of water, something that we take advantage of here in America, right?
Yeah.
So I try to think outside the box and not just specifically in our own economy. I like to create multiple mini economies, mm-hmm. and that way mm-hmm. everyone gets to benefit.
And I think that's what's missing with this Fortress America approach that is there. You know, we just can't understand how when we interconnect with things, and we have free trade and we have freedom to do things, what a powerful thing that is. But if you're going to shut it down, and if you're going to get territorial and tribal about things, and you're going to regulate everything, you're going to regulate it to death. And that's what I'm afraid we're seeing right now. But we're way over time, so I'm going to need to cut this off. But it's been really fascinating talking to you, John Ferguson. And again, the websites are, he's got javajohns.net. SaxonsUnmanned.com, where you can see the kinds of drones that they manufacture there. And if you want to hear his life story, he's working on JohnBFerguson.com. I'll be checking that out. Thank you so much, John. It was fascinating talking to you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. and the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.